This conference is being recorded.
Welcome back. This is Exopolitics Radio. I'm your host, Alfred Weber, and today we have an extraordinary three-hour special program entitled Project Mars, Successfully Outing the Secret Mars Colony, with two extraordinary guests, Andrew D. Bishago, who is known to many of you Exopolitics Radio listeners. Andy's a pioneer in the time-space age and a whistleblower who was a childhood participant in Project Pegasus, a secret DARPA program for time travel and teleportation. Andy has been to Mars twice and has written a key document in natural history entitled The Discovery of Life on Mars. His websites are projectpegasus.net and projectmars.net. Joining Andy is our very special guest. We're honored to have her, Laura Magdalene Eisenhower. Laura is the great-granddaughter of U.S. President Dwight D. Eisenhower. She is a whistleblower who in 2006 was attempted to be recruited on a secret Mars colony. Laura has degrees and certifications in science, wilderness expedition, leadership, natural healing, and building. She is a mythic cosmologist, global strategist, clairvoyant healer, earth advocate, and artist. Ms. Eisenhower is close to the principle of Sophia, saying, quote, "Sophia is not a goddess for women or men exclusively. She will give us a totality of wisdom if we accept her for both the practical earth wisdom of the black goddess and the transcendent cosmic wisdom of the world soul, which are equally available to us." Her website is cosmicgaia2012.com. Welcome, Andy and Laura.
Thank you.
You know,
Thank you, Alfred. Could we?
Oh, great. You know, I feel so honored and special to be here with you both, especially since we're, as they might say, quantum entangled. And Andy, you are the person who informed both of us that Laura and I are each in quantum entangled with you, and you are quantum entangled with us, which is a technical term. Could you sort of lead off the program by explaining exactly what is meant by that and what the implications might be?
Yes, it's actually quite astounding. But during all of my experiences in Project Pegasus as a child, from the time that I first teleported to Santa Fe, New Mexico with my father during the 1967-68 time frame, until I completed my activities on behalf of DARPA at the end of the summer of 1972, different data points about both the broad historical future of humanity and my own discrete future were made known to me. Usually they resulted from me just hearing things that were being said around the lunch or dinner table, for example, or in a bar, when the project principals who were attached to Project Pegasus were sharing data points regarding what they knew about the future. In the mid-summer of 1971, we had been doing chronovisor probes in New Mexico back to the past, and they were trying to see whether they could standardize the process to use it on an ongoing basis for intelligence gathering. So one thing they were doing with me was sending me repeatedly back to the Abraham Lincoln assassination site, to basically Ford's Theater on, what was it, April 14th of 1865. And I was talking my way past the ticket booth, saying my parents had already gone inside and they had the ticket. And they repeatedly sent me back there via hologrammatic immersion. But they found what they were finding, in my case, what they were finding when they were sending other children to other locations in the time-space continuum. And that was announced midsummer 71 at a special meeting at the Sandia Auditorium, which was, quote, "Every time we send the same child or a different child to the same event, it changes a little bit. And therefore, while intelligence is being gathered, we can't rely on that intelligence to make conclusions about what the past or future necessarily holds." Now, that was using the chronovisor technology, one of the many different quantum access technologies that we're developing. So they made a decision that they were announcing at that meeting. And there were actually groans in the audience. There were about 20 or 30 project people present. My dad was there. We were there with our friend Connie Chavez. She had been invited by my father to the meeting. And my father was actually quite angry as we walked out of that meeting. They had literally shut down a major component of the program, not because it wasn't gathering intelligence that was fascinating and might hold keys to better understanding the past and future, but simply because it wasn't reliable enough, especially in light of the inherent dangers to the children involved. So what was decided around that time, because the project had come into possession of my memoir that I'm currently writing about my project experiences, they had identified the fact that I was destined to become the principal whistleblower regarding Project Pegasus. And so my father was tasked with the responsibility to learn more about my discrete destiny. They thought, well, if one of the children of one of the principal engineers on the project is now we see there's this complication, he's destined to be a whistleblower, he's advanced to the far stages of what we're doing. I mean, he's jumped through all the hoops. You know, we're planning to send him to the year 2045 to recover data scrolls of future events. You know, he's one of the leading children among the 140 American school children in the project. We certainly can't send him out of the project at this point. And we also know if he's sitting around listening to our conversations, this is going to become part of the historical record that he'll be revealing in 40 years. So it was there in the mid-summer of 71 that I essentially became persona non grata in a very strange way in the context of the project. I mean, people on the project were still smiling at me and patting my head every once in a while, but they still knew that I had basically been reclassified as somebody who could potentially be a threat to operational security, because Project Pegasus was absolutely top secret. In fact, they moved the chronovisor from the General Manufacturing Company facility in Convent Station, New Jersey, in the fall of 1970, to a building undergoing historical renovation in downtown historical Morristown, New Jersey, because two boys had come in on their Stingrays, you know, on their Stingray bicycles, and just seen what was going on. And they actually moved the project location. That was viewed, you know, two kids on their bikes were viewed as a threat to operational security. So I was treated sort of in a strange way socially from that point forward. So what ended up happening is, during that second half of the summer of 1971. Now, when I say summer of 71, I mean the first summer of 1971 that my father and I experienced, because we teleported from New Jersey to New Mexico at the beginning of the summer of 1971, had a set of experiences in New Mexico that quote-unquote summer, and then when we teleported back to New Jersey at the end of that summer, we found ourselves arriving on the afternoon of the morning we had left, and hence relive the summer of 1971 over again. So from the perspective of my siblings, you know, I went camping with them in Maine during this. My dad and I, you know, our second summer of 1971, because we had had this interlude, this quantum interlude, in which we had gone to New Mexico and done things and then teleported back and lived an entirely different summer of 71 over again. There were four phantom summers like that inserted into my experiences during those 4 or 5 years there. And it was on that basis that secret activities were carried out in New Mexico that enabled the United States, for example, to win the Cold War, because that type of activity kept us that many steps ahead of the former Soviet Union. So my memories regarding these issues of quantum entanglement sort of begin from that period, because it was then that project principals, including my father, most especially my dad, but other people he was talking to on the project, were really focusing on, well, okay, you know, what happens to Andy? Who influences him? Who are the major people that are part of this truth campaign that he leads at midlife, you know, 40 years from now? We have these names of people that are on documents that he has either written or edited or that are in his memoir as having some kind of success. And I remember a couple of the times when one of the names of somebody whose path I would cross in the future came up, when my father was having these types of discussions with either project principals like Dr. Harold M. Agnew or the defense attaché to Project Pegasus, who was Donald Rumsfeld, who would go on to be defense secretary for Presidents Ford and George W. Bush. And I'm happy to say that among all of the 7.5 billion people in the world, I'm honored to be on the show today with Alfred Lambermont Weber and Laura Magdalene Eisenhower, because your names came up. were quantum entangled in the sense that I was given prior knowledge of your identity because you were identified as figures in my biography, but more importantly, in the future history of the disclosure movement in a significant enough way for the project to make note of as it was accessing information from the future, doing things like creating holographic renderings of future events. But this kind of data would have come, for example, by going forward in time and retrieving artifacts like books and microfilm scrolls of future events, which is one of the things we involved in,
Laura.
taking them back to the present. Let me start with Alfred first, because I'm pretty sure that his name came up first. And you know, my dad was really in a feverish state at this point. He was inside a classified defense research and development program where if he violated his secrecy oath and talked about what we were doing, they had promised that they would not only kill him, they would kill our entire family. In fact, that generation of American defense engineers actually signed loyalty agreements in which they agreed to be retaliated against in the event that they violated their oaths. I was asked to sign an oath of, I don't know whether it was loyalty or secrecy, on Defense Department letterhead in October of 1969, when I was age 7 going on age 8 as I began my third grade year. So that's how sensitive the project was, and my dad is in this highly consternated state because he knows I'm the principal whistleblower, and yet I've been trained to participate in the most advanced probes to the past and future that the project was then undertaking, and he had then been tasked to kind of clean up the problem and figure out, well, why does Andy end up becoming this, you know, troublemaker in the future? Why does he become this so-called planetary whistleblower rather than one of our leading chrononauts? And so there was an incident in the summer of 1971 there where my dad and I were dining with his longtime friend and sometime female companion, Mary Constance Chavez. Connie Chavez was born in Old Town Albuquerque in 1928. She died there at Presbyterian Hospital in 1981. She lived most of her life in Old Town Albuquerque. And my dad had met her when he was flight testing the ramjet engine at the White Sands Proving Grounds in 1953-54. They met while they were separately visiting the San Gregorio Diablo missions, which if you look on a map of New Mexico is about halfway between White Sands and her lifelong home in Old Town Albuquerque. And Connie and I were sitting there at a restaurant. It wasn't the La Hacienda or La Placida where she worked. It was another restaurant in town. And so she was sort of getting away from her work. My dad was engaging in some downtime with me from the project. And he said, listen, I've got to go get something from the car. He came back about 5 or 10 minutes later with a black satchel about the size of the bags that we put our personal computers in, actually very close to that size. But it was leather and had a plastic transparent envelope on the front that a kind of a library buck slip had been slipped into. And he unzipped it, and he pulled out the 2005 Universe Books edition of Alfred Lambermont Weber's book, Exopolitics, Politics, Law, and Government in the Universe. It was the edition that Alfred, you and I, and you wrote, and that I helped you edit and design back in 2005. My dad read it a little bit and then handed it over to Connie, and it was Connie's response to that work that led to a discussion of, you know, she was asking questions like, who is Alfred Lambermont Weber? Who is this President Carter that we see identified as the originator of the quotation on the inside, you know, front pages there of your book. My dad was being somewhat critical. He said something like, well, in 2005, he's 43 years old, and he's only editing a book. Why didn't he write it? You know, my dad was one of those fathers who didn't really have a huge amount of praise to heap on his children. And so Connie said something like, well, Ray, look at this quote here. And she read the quotation by Brian O'Leary, and said, Ray, that's an astronaut. Now, this is a special look. And look at all these prestigious people in the front of the book. And she started to go through some of the names of the people who wrote endorsements for the front of your book, Alfred. So, you know, I know to a personal certainty that you and I were quantum entangled in the sense that your name and this book that I helped you work on with you, assisting you as your editor, was a quantum artifact that was retrieved from the future and was not only in the possession of the Defense Department. It was one of those pieces of evidence that was sort of put in the file during that second summer of 1971, when my dad had literally been tasked by the Defense Department to study my future and to be able to derive, I guess, some official finding about what happens in my future that led me to identify with the broader interests of the human race and not adhere to the secrecy regime and sort of the defense mission of Project Pegasus. Obviously, the abuse that was heaped on us in the program was a major part of that, but I'm really motivated by the fact that I believe that we're going to need to implement teleportation to achieve planetary sustainability in the 21st century. And so my whistleblower campaign is not really, doesn't really emanate completely or for the most part from any lingering anger I feel at my, some of the negative experiences I had in the project. It's really driven by the idealism of the fact that Tesla's technologies in this area never should have been weaponized. We should be living in a world where we were teleporting, at least between major cities, and getting rid of commercial airliners for over 40 years. You know, in fact, I was present at a seminar in which we were asked what was the future significance of these technologies. And I mentioned the fact that teleportation would allow us to at least get rid of commercial airliners and all of the greenhouse gases and toxins and the pollutants that they emit. And just to give you the sort of time reference here, this is the time that Al Gore is sitting up at Harvard, you know, first tackling the global warming issue as an undergraduate under Roger Revelle at Harvard. So we could have been living in a world in which we were teleporting like this for the last 40 years. And that's driving my truth campaign. But I know that they knew that you and I would have a significant personal and professional friendship in the future. And clearly, they wanted, you know, they placed your book, Exopolitics, in the file that they were assembling regarding me. And I think the significance of this is that then, well, there are a couple. One operates on the political level, and then the other operates sort of on the quantum entanglement level. On the political level, this means that your role as one of the leaders of the disclosure movement, in the way that we would associate somebody like William Lloyd Garrison or Wendell Phillips with the abolition movement, was identified by the minions of Donald Rumsfeld and this essentially Nixon Republican team, sort of the Richard Nixon secret team that was actually administering Project Pegasus. So any political warfare that's been directed against you since then very well may have emanated from the fact that your leadership role in the disclosure movement was identified 40 years ago. And I think on the quantum entanglement level, beyond our friendship, there's the fact that, as you know, let me narrate it, though, when we were finishing the book, I accessed these memories, and so we had the unusual experience as a writing and editing team of completing the first book with knowledge, not just knowledge that it would be written, or that is to say prior knowledge of its authorship, but with an awareness of the fact that the book, as it exists today, was literally in my presence as a child before we would write it 40 years later, or 35 years later. So in that context where my dad was sometimes pulling a book out of a satchel like that, there was sometimes sort of ordinary, sort of convivial lunchtime discussion about different things the future held. I know that they had prior knowledge of the attacks of 9/11, the emergence of AIDS as an epidemic disease, the advent of the Internet was discussed in my presence. They knew who you were, and they knew that together we would roll out the information regarding the quantum cover-up, because it was in that context where they were worrying about ultimate public scrutiny of them as this clandestine team who was enabling the United States Defense Department basically to possess the keys to the past and the future. In that context, Laura's name came up. There was I was at a lunch where there was a reference to the fact that I would meet a female descendant of President Dwight David Eisenhower. And I believe that Connie had previously heard this anecdote and said, the granddaughter, right, Ray? And my dad said, no, the great-granddaughter of President Eisenhower. And I remember Laura's name actually being used. They said to me, well, what's her name? And my father said, Laura Eisenhower. And this couldn't have been after 1972, so this is actually several years before Laura was born. Her identity as a leader of the modern disclosure movement regarding the sequestration of these life-advantaging technologies, the covert plan to establish a secret colony on Mars, and the other things that together we're working on today was something that was also detected by Project Pegasus, and indeed, Laura's name and identity was in the project file. I remember being discussed in front of me. Now, of course, that's obviously going to be of interest to a group of Nixon Republicans working in the early days of time-space physics for Donald Rumsfeld's secret program, because, of course, President Nixon had been vice president to President Eisenhower, and because we've only had, by then we had only had 37 presidents, anybody from a presidential family who somebody has personal or professional contact with that's going to be a fact that's scrutinized simply because of the preeminence of the presidency in American culture. So that was something they were interested in, as if they had said, oh, well, he ends up, pitching for the New York Mets. It was just a fascinating piece of Americana that they were just delighted to find out about, but they were also scrutinizing that information because they knew that I would meet Laura in the context of the disclosure movement and its implicit response to the secret regime that they were part of, and the ultimate liberation of this information so that we can use these technologies to advantage humanity. So just to broadly kind of sum up, both of you were identified as principal figures in the disclosure movement, and they knew that the three of us were quantum entangled in some significant way, because those two references to each of you occurred very close in time. And it was really when my dad was trying to piece together, okay, well, what does he do with this disclosure career that he leads, that he begins in his 40s and becomes publicly known for? There was also a one-off discussion with Connie and I at the poolside when she was babysitting me one time, in which she stopped and had this serious discussion with me about the leadership role that I was destined to play in the disclosure movement. She spoke about it in very broad terms, not entirely understanding what this movement would encompass, but I think from her perspective, she understood that it involved revealing the fact that we've been contacted by extraterrestrials, revealing the fact that the U.S. government has been concealing advanced technologies, even technologies that can be used to allow people to move between distant events in the quantum hologram, and other major cover-ups that inevitably the disclosure movement is going to confront in our lifetime. So, we begin today's interview with really a remarkable data point, which is that the three of us are specifically quantum entangled because I was given knowledge of your names and identities and that I would be entangled with you on a professional and creative basis 40 years ago when I was a little kid. And so for me, this is a very special interview.
Thank you, Andy.
I'm glad you should have.
Yeah, sure. That's a remarkable, and just thinking about that, Laura, the first thing that occurred to me as I was listening to Andy's account of hearing about you when he was in Project Pegasus in the early 70s as a 6 and 7 year old child, was again what he mentioned to me, and that is at the political level, and that is the Nixon Republicans, kind of at the administrative level, Project Pegasus being made up of the Nixon secret team, quote unquote, people like Donald Rumsfeld. And I'm just wondering, in light of your talking about previously on Exopolitics Radio, you're feeling targeted from the age of 7. If you could walk us through your feelings hearing from Andy about this quantum entanglement, does this connect any dots for you, or what's your reaction?
Well, the dots are getting more and more connected every day, it seems. The more I listen to him, the more we all, converse together. I have recently discovered a little bit more about, MJ-12 and treaties with Eisenhower, and alternative 1, 2, and 3. And I think what we're creating here is an alternative 4. Alternative 2 and 3 relating to, underground base bases and, you know, bases on different planets and missions to get us off the planet, exchanges with technologies that could control this process, because alternative one is connected to there not being any plan of action, but just sort of writing things out and hoping everything's going to be okay in regards to communications with aliens and particularly the ones that wanted our help to be sure that their race could survive. So a lot of decisions were made during these years and way before as to how to handle these threats. From my knowledge, there's been agreements between aliens and people. Some are merged agendas. And what I've discovered from listening to Andy is that he was a part of one of these plans to, you know, move a portion of the population off of Earth in the event of, you know, wars or cataclysms, whether man-made or natural or both due to the result of pulling a lot of those with strong Earth missions off the planet. I see that there's a lot that is out of control. So the dots that are connecting for me is that we all hold a little piece, a huge piece actually, of a, I wouldn't call the word solution, but a integration and a completion of what all these different strands of information, including, you know, on all levels, technological, political, metaphysical, esoterical, everything. We're sort of converging, and from that point that we are, you know, coming together, birthing a whole new concept. Now that the whistle is being blown, it's starting to create disclosure a lot quicker on levels that aren't controlled by an organization that's been trying to control this movement and controlling, you know, what presidents hear after things like MJ-12 were developed and those organizations were pulled together. A lot of information coming from a lot of, you know, intelligence agencies and hidden groups and sources have agendas that aren't necessarily giving us the absolute truth. So I see that we're all digging way deeper than most can comprehend, and that the dots are being connected as we talk, because, you know, we're each coming in with a different thing. My Mars recruitment happened in 2006, but I did feel that I was being tested or harassed. You know, my partners were, and when I see the connection between human and alien and what has happened throughout history as far as the ETs go and the different exchanges of technologies, I see where a lot of these merge in a larger agenda and a larger plan, partly fear-based, partly due to wanting control of the human race, and, you know, it's a mixed bag of who actually has what intention. A large portion of that population is more fear-based and, you know, trying to come up with a solution to preserve our species. But the main ringleaders behind it have something far worse going on that does not appreciate our free will and the creative energy and our ability to shift things and create new circumstances based on accessing abilities that are in unison with these technologies and even beyond it. So we have both technological things, and then we're waking up to the fact that we are not even using our the full extent of our intelligence and capabilities on multiple levels. That's been suppressed in us. So the technology that we have, just on an organic level, we're beginning to wake up to, which is far more powerful than, you know, a lot of the things that have been manipulating us. So as Andy's saying, a lot of the technologies that he's aware of could really help the human race. I think everything that we possibly need on all the levels of having enough resources to shift everything in a positive direction is there. It's just similar to light and dark. These things are being used in the wrong places, they're being directed by the wrong forces, and I just see the dots connecting as being able to come up with a system and a model based on multi-level aspects of everything connected to this, and being able to rearrange it to where everything kind of lines up to where it should be, so that when things fall into place on a rooted practical level, the as above, so below theory and the metaphysical part of it can begin to fall into place, so that we're not prone to being attacked by parasitic energies. We're understanding ourselves more of an organism that, through raising vibration, are able to deflect the germs, the attack, the lower frequencies that, you know, we have technologies and capabilities just on an organic level in our own nature to overcome and defy and dismantle. And so I just see us, you know, really leading the charge as we dredge up everything and kind of realign it and let it settle back into where it belongs, that we're going to launch and birth a whole new movement that is going to help direct humanity into its, you know, highest destiny and highest potential.
Now, that's a really very insightful and interesting sort of umbrella concept that you've expressed, Laura, alternative four, something that I know I resonate to deeply, and I think it's what Andy, even as a whistleblower at 6 years old, I think that what may have been driving him, but I don't want to put words in his mouth. Andy, how do you react to what Laura was saying in light how she characterized the Project Pegasus sort of Mars colony experience that you know of, and kind of in an alternative three sense, and now how Laura has suggested that what we're really all working on is an alternative four. What are your thoughts on that?
I really find it astonishing that her wonderful summary of what we're now doing puts in words things that as a child when I was on the project I could only intuit emotionally and even viscerally. I knew as a child on the program that there was something wrong with the direction that the elders in my enabling environment were going. The project was fear-based. They were maintaining the strictest project secrecy, although it was clear to me that we were doing technical feats inside the project that everybody should experience and that the whole human race should be using. There was abusive treatment of us. There was an attempt to achieve our obedience through both fear and intimidation and things that today would violate the torture convention, certainly the legislation protecting human subjects, and certainly child abuse legislation around the country. So we were being mistreated. There was, of course, the ontological stress of simply doing such strange and far-out things as a kid and being one of the first human kids to experience them. But as you know, I took action as a child on the program to try to sabotage the program because I intuited, I would say almost on a transcendental or soul level, that I should. And I could really never articulate why I not only wanted to do so, but did so. I did so by leaving a note in the Bataan Memorial Building that I had written at Curtis Wright when we teleported there one morning in April of 1971. You know, so just to give the time reference there, that the date that I put on that note was April 9th, 1971, which as a 9-year-old, I turned 10 in September of 71. And that was 2 weeks before 26-year-old John Kerry appeared before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee to provide whistleblower testimony about American atrocities in Vietnam. But I was not a politicized child. My parents were devout Roman Catholics, my father Republican, my mother a Democrat. I remember my father had said that he voted a straight Republican ticket for president, except Presidents Kennedy and Truman. So he was a fairly open-minded individual in that sense. I was certainly not abused at home. I was being raised in a wonderful household. But quietly on the corners of the program, individuals who had a different agenda than what my father understood from the project were doing things like electromagnetically shocking us when we would return to Curtis Wright via teleportation. There was one activity involving the induction of fear that took place at a local military base that I'd rather not narrate this afternoon, but that I'm going to be describing in my book that was quite horrific. So on one level, I was simply fighting back in response to the abuse that was occurring in the project. on another level, I realized that we shouldn't be keeping these technologies secret. I had a sense of spiritual yearning or kind of an upwelling of conscientiousness or an understanding that I had some kind of larger role to play in society. It's very hard to describe. I almost had a sense of my destiny as an individual, and so I was trying to express that as a kid. I heard some of that just in the conversations that were held of an informal nature on the project. I was never briefed about what my future held, and I certainly wasn't brainwashed or mind-controlled to remember things and begin talking about them. Quite the contrary. When my project experiences ended, I was a victim of basically a torture session in which an atrocious headache was produced, and they attempted to brainwash me to experience this kind of headache whenever I thought about or wanted to talk or write about what I experienced in Project Pegasus. So the true story is that I overcame pretty brutal brainwashing to be able to remember and memorialize what happened and share my experiences with others. And I was fighting to do that the entire time I was in the project. So, for example, when I knew we were in Santa Fe and I knew we were going to teleport back to Curtis Wright in Woodridge, New Jersey, and be taken inside the building and electromagnetically shocked with a metal halo around our foreheads for 30 seconds, which I understand dumps endorphins into the human brain that tends to impede the uptake of short-term memory into intermediate and long-term memory. I actually memorized a number of establishments on Cerritos Road in Santa Fe, which was the King's Rest Inn, the Thunderbird Motel, and the Village Inn, in a kind of a cipher in my mind. Now, curiously, when I went back on my fact-finding trips in 2003, 4, and 8, back to New Mexico, I found that despite all of the gentrification and development, the really robust suburban and ex-urban development in Santa Fe since the time of the early 70s, those were still the three establishments that still existed on Cerritos Road, those three landmarks. I could see as a kid that they had been there for a long time, and so I figured they would continue to be there in the future. And I was right. They are the only three original buildings that are still on Cerritos Road as you go from I-25 up to the state capitol complex. So I was doing things like that. I was literally trying to create ciphers in my mind that would survive the brainwashing that I knew I would then be subjected to. So I was fighting back. I was refusing to be oppressed by them. I was angry at the injustice of what was happening. And even though I was a very well-behaved child, I was not only going to school, but Sunday school. We were going to confession on Saturday nights and taking the Eucharist at church on Sunday morning. And I was being raised in a fairly strict Catholic household. I still rebelled quite strenuously when I was on the project and tried to subvert it. And they knew of those activities on the project as well as they then correlated those to my wider destiny when I grew up. And I'm focusing that destiny on what Laura has just so brilliantly articulated, which is a matter of freeing ourselves from this fear-based infrastructure that's been put in place in which we are not preserving our environment here on Earth. We are regimenting people slavishly in an advanced technocratic nightmare to really achieve such peculiar objectives as placing a human survival colony on Mars. And in a sense, the meta purpose. Hello?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So I never could really articulate it as a child on the project, but this is what my intuitions have led me to, is involvement now in a burgeoning mass movement in which we will demand the U.S. government tell the truth to us. We will demand that they declassify these life-advantaging technologies and start going about the business of not teleporting people to Mars so they can create a survival colony there, but using these technologies here on Earth to make Earth a survival colony in and of itself, and do so by tapping the net resources of the human species, which, again, is something also that Laura just articulated and I find so compelling. I ended up being drawn into the environmental movement. As a young man, I sought out people like Buckminster Fuller. I did some writing for Jacques Cousteau's organization. And after college, I went on to study environmental law and policy fairly strenuously. And I think ultimately these interlocking issues, the existence of life event technologies, the technologies that we can use to achieve sustainability here on Earth, the hidden history of the secret space program, and this attempt to get a contingent of human beings off planet, are all things that are coming to the fore at this time. But unlike the environmentalism of the 1970s, we're going to be talking about these issues in light of the notion that one of the critical dimensions of the environmental movement, arguably the most important issue in the environmental movement, is the declassification of technologies that we can use to achieve planetary sustainability. And I think the Mars colony relates to that almost as a negative example. It shows that my instincts were right as a child, that these secret defense projects were misguided. They were misdirected. Instead of weaponizing teleportation, for example, we should have been using it to move people about the planet with very little input of time, energy, or material, and very little output of pollution. And now, 40 years later, we have a distinguished former vice president, Al Gore, winning a Nobel Peace Prize for quite responsibly campaigning regarding the threat posed to our civilization by climate change, but we haven't yet declassified the technologies that the U.S. government is in possession of that will enable us to address climate change effectively. And so I think at a certain point here, the environmental movement and the disclosure movement are going to reach a point of critical convergence, and that's what I think our conversation now is actually leading to.
Laura, you were about to say something.
Yes. I had a few thoughts based on what he was saying. I can't remember where I jumped in, but a few things popped up. As far as the site, you know, finding that place in your brain so that you have something return to so that you're not brainwashed and you can continue the fight, you're focusing on what your intuition is telling you, and you're kind of creating little reserves that you can return to. And what's interesting is I remember being out of my body for a good portion of my life. The only way that I could battle these energies was to not even inhabit my body and to sort of observe what was happening. And in that process, I recall going through, you know, all these different layers and practically battling inorganic energies to get to a particular place that seemed to bust through timelines as I was going. Certain things that had been solidified or prophesized or, you know, especially related to doom scenarios, I just remember sort of breaking through and tearing through with the refusal to be controlled by it. And so, you know, part of the loss of, you know, maybe amnesia to what the mission is was very difficult for me. I mean, it was very hard for me to lose focus because I was able to just, you know, get away from the frequencies and somehow keep my physical body alive while I kind of went into a lot of other dimensions to kind of get through, even around 9/11, that it got really accelerated. Sort of like this alarm goes off and you're doing work that has nothing to do with what the earth is telling you or what the fear scenarios are telling you. It was guided by something so much deeper and more profound. And, you know, I find that these groups that are trying to run the show and keep all the secrecy, you know, when we think about how much of the human mind that we use or our own abilities, the percentages are under 10%. And that's probably because that percentage is actually running the country. And that leaves about 90% of us that have our missions buried, neglected, manipulated, mind controlled. So obviously, if that could stop, we have plenty of resources just within each individual for us to all connect the dots. But we're functioning on such a small level with just, you know, a few groups that have taken it upon their hands to make these huge decisions for humanity that have completely robbed everybody of having a chance to, you know, put their genius in or put their inventions in and their ideas in. And so, you know, just as we function on such a small percentage, so is this planet. And so this movement, you know, no matter what planet we go to, we can't get away from the aliens or the agreements. I mean, I don't know why that's even a plan as far as rescuing anything. We have to handle what these things are right here and right now and stop putting the money into, you know, what's being feared and start to put it into the solution because everything we could possibly need is here right now. And that's just like running away, but it doesn't solve anything. And so that's why I know that the agendas that relate to my recruitment and Andy's and why we all three are here together and our names all came up is because there's something behind it that is making these agreements to where humans are being guided by those agendas and have made some sort of agreement to uphold it and keep it in secrecy, to allow this to be done based on control and power more so than looking out for us as a human race, or else we would be able to function at our highest potential and we wouldn't be ripping through, you know, these extreme harassments and forces that have tried to stop us, that, you know, Andy and I and others and you as well have been able to break through by getting to the other side and allowing ourselves to kind of die. I had to die a numerous amount of times so that I could preserve my own information because it was being robbed and stealed and basically taken away. It was like my soul and everything was trying to be destroyed. It's like they were trying to buy it and use it, not buy it, but take it over. And so I was really relating to Andy with the absolute refusal of it. It was about 20 years of my life, just that struggle on a daily, hour-to-hour basis. And it really reached a critical point when the Mars recruitment came, when I was really able to break free, when everything that I'd ever gone through seemed to, everything that I was feeling and thinking and knowing, it was all familiar. I was like, these are the people. These are the ones that have been doing this to me for as long as I can remember. God knows how many lifetimes. So, you know, after breaking through on a multidimensional level of all these barriers and all these negative timelines and all these fear scenarios and all these blockages and obstacles, I realized, meeting both of you, that we've torn through to the other side. And it isn't even something that, I mean, it can be predicted through what Andy was exposed to, but, you know, Project Looking Glass, and I have a quote, they can't see what's happening past 2012. First of all, alternative 2 and 3 were built on the basis that things would be happening in the year 2000 that would threaten our life, and that didn't happen. So, you know, here we are maintaining our minds, our wisdom, our souls, and our creativity, and we've created a whole new thing that I don't think anybody can even, you know, point a finger at and even determine, you know, where is that going to lead to, because in a sense it's liberation. And 2012 on so many different levels represents, you know, a complete and total liberation from time itself and, you know, an opening up that, you know, certain timelines are being preserved that then many might not walk down. So I feel like we're holding the torch and the flame for one that can set us free. And I know that I held on to that and I didn't lose it, and I feel the victory in me that it's like, oh my gosh, we did it. We did it. Like, we're home free. There's a lot of stuff that still needs to be sorted out. There's a lot of work ahead. But as far as being able to survive past these scenarios and past these, you know, different agendas and timelines and prophecies that all relate to doom and fear, we've ripped open a whole other portal to the other side, and that gateway is ready for us to walk through. And my life was focused on making sure of that and keeping that open. And it took everything out of me. So, but today and in the last year, I have felt the victory, and the attacks have stopped, and all that falseness and all these things have just sort of faded away, and I see the horizon of what we're about, and I can confidently say that there's really nothing that can get in the way now, except for our own resistance, which none of us have here.
Well, from the point of view of hindsight, kind of looking through the rearview mirror, I know that we surfaced a lot of the initial story of the attempted recruitment in 2006 into the Mars colony, this type of alternative 3 scenario, very much the type of Mars colony that Andy was involved in, starting with Project Pegasus and then continuing with his two visits to Mars in 1981. Could you highlight for our audience, because there was an initial reaction from some of the parties involved and from some of what we like to call the aviary, but now that's kind of died down. If you could share from our audience, really at this distance now, some of the highlights of what occurred without necessarily naming any names, but just for a matter of history, so that people can begin to understand what happened to you then?
After we wrote that up, or at what point?
I mean, just kind of walk us through it, because I think that when you appeared on ExoPolitics Radio last was like one of the first public surfacings of the story. And now a huge amount of, now there's been a lot of public processing of it. And just to kind of set the record straight now as to some of the issues that have been raised.
Right.
Just state it from your point of view, clarify, you know, that you do have your birth certificate, you do have your driver's license, you do have tons of emails, there have been journalists, just, you know, just send out some facts for the folks.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, after all that, there was everything sort of coming at me, wanting to discount even my identity, and that, you know, it's all fiction and I'm in fantasy land, which is nice. First off, I do have a birth certificate. My legal birth name was Laura Madeline Bradshaw. My mom got remarried and wanted us to take the last name, but the name would have been too long, and she wanted us to have Eisenhower, her maiden name, in her name, and I think maybe she had some intuitive sense that this kind of belongs in our name. So it was legally changed when I was 11 to Laura Bradshaw Eisenhower Mahan, Mahan being my stepdad's name. Well, the Madeline got dropped, but that's on my birth certificate. So what I have is Laura Madeline Bradshaw, which is my blood father Bradshaw, who became a Catholic priest, which is a whole other story, what experiences that led me to. And then at 11, I have the legal papers that say, and my driver's license and passport now say Laura Bradshaw Eisenhower Mahan. Okay, so that's my name. Great. Well, why am I on the family tree online? I can't say I don't know. I mean, three grandchildren aren't there, but obviously I have friends and family that have met, you know, my family. I grew up in D.C., and my whole high school, you know, was aware of my family. So these aren't difficult things to prove. So I'm not going to ramble on about that.
Yeah. And your mother's website, without mentioning her name, has you listed as her child. So you are acknowledged by your mother as the great-granddaughter of President Dwight D. Eisenhower.
Right. So that's all cleared up. I am... And then beyond that, you know, all this fantasy stuff. So what I did, I found an old email account that I almost forgot about. I found first a few emails about the mission, about the panic, the need to get there in 5 years, the name of the ship being called Sophia and the other one Merlin, but only Sophia is mentioned in the email, which I still have. You know, it talks about 11 ships, 11 escort ships, and the necessity because of World War III, World War IV, alien wars, cataclysms, all fear-based. And so then I found 200 emails, which I thought I didn't have. I actually told you folks that I only had a draft, but no, I actually did find about 200 emails where I'm really trying to figure this out. I'm trying to make sure, you know, Agent X or my partner was okay. I'm trying to really just ground, you know, the earthly missions and hoping that we can discuss both. I had no voice. I had no say. It was all chaos. And I have, you know, 200 emails that aren't about the relationship. No, they're about the mission on Earth. They're about inquiring why this is happening, why he was sent to find me. I have a draft saved that I never sent because I got to ask him in person, you know, not really believing that he was sent to find me because it just seemed so odd to me. But the things he started talking about immediately after he met me related to, you know, a lot that was brought up at a later time. So I do have those emails, and there's been things written lately in articles. Gary Beckham, who, you know, validated the fact that there was a Mars colony, Mars mission, 2012 being the date, but the funding seemed very small. So what the conclusions that I've drawn is that what he used the term compartmentalism, where you can be doing a mission or having a specific role, but you don't know what's really behind it. You have orders. You listen to things. I mean, Agent X listened to what he called the patrons, but then was in these groups and, you know, planning this mission with others. But a lot of the information wasn't even coming from physical beings. They were coming from, you know, like ET sources. And this is what leads to, you know, the question of what's the difference between a false abduction and a real one, and how there's a manipulation in order to bring agents in by manipulating and using alien technology to serve those agendas, which I really felt was happening when I was involved in it, and I hadn't really done any online research to validate that that's actually been written about. But so, you know, the panic and the pandemonium surrounding all this didn't give me much of a voice. For 6 months, I tried really hard to not only help them, but to, you know, speak my truth. And I felt like I'm not the kind of person that should be ignored. You can't drag somebody like me to some planet and not give me the time of day to talk and have an opinion about it and have, you know. So anyway, as far as any sort of backlash, I have proof on, you know, a lot of levels. But the proof only goes so far. There's so many things that are behind each thing that I share that, you know, the ones that I've named before might not even know about. So I'm not going to bring up names anymore. All I can do is bring up the fact that between Andy and I and you, Alfred, we have a larger story, and I think it's way larger than Agent X even knew. And I think that there's a progression of this whole Mars thing, and it's happened in different layers and levels. Sort of taking on a chronological thing that is where this thing is becoming public now and is starting to draw in, you know, the potential to get people to Mars through things like Google XPRIZE. Well, to be in our shoes, Andy and I know that there's a lot more to it than just that. There's a lot more behind it that is, you know, potentially going to create an uproar and a panic that people are going to want to flee, because the main thing that was trying to get me to go was exactly those things, you know, World War III, World War IV, you know, cataclysms. So people are going to hear those things. We can choose to create. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Well, we can choose to create from those fear scenarios. And so, okay, I guess to set the record straight, I have emails. Articles have been written. I do have proof of my identity. I have proof of not just my birth identity, but my, I guess you could say, archetypal identity. I've about as much proof as you can get on that level, including sound technologies. And that's, you know, I don't feel like going out of my way to push that one, because it's something I'm really here to awaken in others. But if anybody needed that as well, I can provide that. So everything coming at me has not been difficult for me, because I have evidence and backup, and you know, I feel that we're together to help us figure out where we don't have answers, and there's, you know, certain areas that just haven't been explained, and that's why I'm gaining so much from these conversations, because not everybody has all the facts, but there's a source that does, and it doesn't want to tell us the truth. Disclosure is got a lot of layers to it. Where's true disclosure compared to telling us something that isn't really the truth, which is very similar to the difference between false alien abductions and the real ones. So the real deal now is there's a battle between good and evil, and now there's a battle between fact and fiction and spirit against negative technologies, and, you know, all these wars are emerging from this, and I think the way we're handling it by focusing on the positive timeline and really creating this new alternative campaign that transcends anything we've ever heard before, which is based on our free will and creativity, we can take it to the next level. But like I said, if I haven't been able to explain it enough, I'm happy to be contacted and provide the proof, as long as it's, you know, necessary and it's to people that, you know, really need to hear it. I have all of that.
Well, I thought it was important to ask that. Not so much from a legal courtroom drama point of view, establishing your identity, but because as I surf the internet, I've noticed from the various email chat rooms that there's been a meme created, because people have either done faulty research or haven't done thorough research, that they've only gone so far. And then dismiss the issue. So, Laura, could you keep on talking? I have to take a call, I think, from Andy. Okay.
Okay. Yeah. So there's a lot of different things that came as far as doubts and speculation.
Okay.
People heard about the Mars. They kind of dismissed the story because the whole idea of a Mars colony was too much. So there was two different things. She probably isn't really an Eisenhower, and this Mars thing seems crazy. But then there's Andy, and there's, you know, now Gary wrote that article, and there's a lot more coming to the surface to really alleviate a lot of those doubts and where people have felt, you know, like the story's not even worth their attention, which was a lot of what happened right away. A lot of people were just, you know, blowing it off because of those initial things that you mentioned, which are very much easily proved and validated at this point. So,
well, you know, I think that Andy may have been having difficulties accessing our conversation. So,
you with us?
So I am going to ask you a question, which is a very deep one,
mm-hmm.
And I'm going to ask you to answer that as fully as you can. I may not be here for a while because I'm going to contact Andy to see if we can resolve some of the technical difficulties.
Okay.
But if you could talk more about the return of the divine feminine,
mm-hmm.
and your closeness to the principle of the goddess Sophia, and how... Andy,
yeah.
Oh, good. You're back. Oh, good. Well, hold that particular question, Laura.
And
we are going to get to that question because I see that as a key component of alternative four.
Yes.
Andy, what Laura was addressing was some of the issues that came up in her exposure to the kind of alternative three energies, which actually encompassed a good deal of her life, and most accentuated during the period of her attempted recruitment starting in 2006 into a secret Mars colony. And we were just going over some of the facts of that. And what I wanted to do then is to even provide a further validation or alternative point. By the way, we're about one-third into our program. It's a little bit more than an hour into the program. Is if we could explore just for a while the evidence and life story of a very interesting gentleman who has come forth as a disclosure witness to the secret Mars colony, and that's Michael Relf, R-E-L-F-E. And you can Google him, and you go to his website online, and you can download two. One book is 370 pages. The other is 280 or some odd pages. I've read them both. They're written by his wife, who was assisted him in downloading, in accessing his memories. Just to summarize it, he says that he was stationed on Mars for 20 years, that basically there are two classes of people in the secret Mars colony. One class is what he calls the visitors, and they are generally VIPs in the political or the technocratic class, who come for a couple of weeks or a day or 2 days, and they are not time-traveled. The other are the permanent staff who are stationed there for 20 years, and they are time-traveled so that, as Andy said, what occurred to him in his four phantom summers, they're actually sent up there for a phantom 20 years. And he was up there from 1976 to 1996. He was recruited in the Great Lakes area. teleported time travel teleported up to Mars, and then his memories are wiped at the end of the 20-year term. He also states that reptilians and greys are intimately involved in the project, and that, as I discussed in one of my Examiner articles, that the Pine Gap Australia underground complex is one of the great bases that basically is run by reptilians and greys and human military personnel, and maybe a large teleportation base. And when I met with and interviewed another Mars teleportee visitor to the Seeker Mars project, former DOD scientist Arthur Neumann in Barcelona, Spain, in July of 2006, he showed me his official DOD U.S. passport, which had a visa, their official DOD visa to Australia, so which he used for entry and exit to the Pine Gap base. Now, so I just want to bring up those two comments that he made about the two classes of people into the secret Mars base with this comment, that Michael Ralph and his wife have both Andrew Bishago and Laura Magdalene Eisenhower on the home page as two distinguished cases of other people who have been involved and who are whistleblowers on the secret Mars project. So he's a deep ally. And Andy, I want to start with you, if what you know in the summary we've just given, if you could comment on the Michael Ralph case as it adds in detail and validation to this whole Alternative 3 secret Mars colony approach.
Right. Well, we talked about how when I was serving on Project Pegasus, there was no direct reference to Mars or any education related directly. You know, they didn't give me an awareness that ultimately the teleportees would be teleporting to Mars. There was certainly instruction on the habitation of space, the kind of scenarios you see with both the text and the drawings associated with Project Moondeck was certainly what we were getting in some of our schooling, that we would become basically astronauts. But the curiosity is we were never being put aboard high-performance jet or rocket aircraft. We were getting extensive schooling and teleportation, but there was no reference to Mars or going off-planet beyond, you know, just the conventional NASA Moondeck kind of coursework. And there was, however, I mentioned one of our previous discussions, around the time that your name came up and Laura Eisenhower's name came up as persons of interest of both a general nature and specifically to the unfolding of my own life, there was an episode in which my father came back to the restaurant where Connie worked, and he was deeply consternated about something he had just learned. As his son, I intuited that it was something that implicated my well-being. And this was already after I had been identified as a whistleblower. In other words, this was already during that second half of the summer of 1971 where we were spending a lot of time driving up to the Sandia National Labs. We're over on the right side of the Sandia campus. There was a viewing room where they were pulling up holograms. And I was standing there in utter frustration trying to assist my father and using my psychic ability to identify who particular people were that they were showing scenes of me interacting with in the future. But in other words,
could you just speak more closely into your telephone?
Yeah, it's a little jumbled. I can't hear you very
right,
well.
Oh, boy. How's that? Is that better?
Yeah, better.
Okay, so there was the episode where my father learned something, and we now think that probably what happened was he was informed that the project was headed towards Mars. In other words, he had implicated me in a time-space program, believing that we were only going to continue to do take travel to the past and future on Earth, and didn't realize that at a certain point it would be integrated with the space program and we would use the teleportation to go off planet. I think that that's what that episode probably involved. I don't think it involved any foreshortening of my life, because my father said during another episode that they had even retrieved images of me working in my early 90s, so they knew I was going to be very long-lived. But he was concerned about something he discovered, and I now think that that was my account of going up to Mars twice in 1981. So I left the project as an 11-year-old. I had a fairly conventional adolescence in Southern California, and I attended junior high and high school in Southern California, and then entered UCLA. And after several years of college, they placed an individual in my life by the name of Courtney M. Hunt, who was a career CIA case officer, basically. And throughout the summer of 1981, Hunt was asking me a question I really didn't want to even be asked. You know, Laura talks about, and I can completely relate to this pattern of having this aversive element in your life, pushing you over towards these Promethean activities, as distinguished from the Dionysian, you know, the technocratic rather than the esotopian or earthian activities that we were actually, that we actually incarnated here on Earth to develop. And I really didn't want to even have, I didn't even want to listen to Hunt asking me the question of whether or not I wanted to go up to Mars. I told him no. You know, I don't want to go into another secret government program and go through all that and the secrecy and the abuse and the fear-based functioning that is part of the very atmosphere of those projects, not just their culture, but they're essentially saturated with the negativity that results from the constant fear and concealment that attends their operation. And so he basically continued to contact me through June of 1981, and I finally asked him, look, why do I have to go up there? Now, what's at stake here? Why do you need me to go up there rather than, let's say, some astronaut trainee or something? At first I asked him, well, how are we going to get up there, via rocket? And he laughed kind of ruefully and said, you know how...
Did we lose him?
Yeah, it sounds like we lost him. Let's just wait for Andy to come back in. I know that he's had some connectivity challenges here. I'd like to go back to the question, and maybe this will be a thread that you and I will follow as we track Andy in this, his parallel challenges to join our conference in terms of alternative four, and that is how you see the return of the divine feminine, and one of the ways that you have accessed this is by having a particular closeness to the principle of Sophia. And I wondered if you could unfold for us, almost from an historical perspective, how this developed in you, and then maybe we could get later on in the program what the implications are for alternative four.
Okay. Well, you know, at a young age, before I was really harassed, there was just a strong awareness that something was going on. And, I mean, I've said this before, maybe in the interview last time, that I felt buried alive in something of a large, you know, many lifetimes, multiple lifetime level I had been going through. And it was almost like I was picking up where I left off before. And I just felt this, you know, deep connection to just all the potential, all the goodness, you know, just, I could feel the heavenly vibration and just source energy. But then I felt, you know, when I grounded myself on Earth, like, this is completely threatened. You know, this is, I'm in for something so excruciating and so challenging as I hold on to this. And I remember between the ages of maybe 7 and 8, or 6 and 8, before I really started to feel attacked, that I was being prepared, you know, by spirit itself or by something in nature just strengthening me and sort of, you know, helping me understand the kind of journey I would have to go through to sort of survive and resurrect. In a sense, so to me, it's sort of kind of like the survival of something in all of us. It's what these agendas have tried to destroy in all of our nature. So kind of like I'm just holding on for dear life to those concepts of unity and spirit and wisdom and freedom and you know, having our destiny and our future, you know, really lift veils and put us in touch with our multidimensional nature, give us access to just abilities that can launch us, you know, to space beyond technology. And I just had this incredible vision of what I, you know, call the positive timeline. I actually had a dream that I looked through a viewfinder of how the future was going to be, and it was a high alien race that allowed me to see it. And, you know, so I held on for dear life just in my communications with the Christ energy and Source energy and even Ike. You know, I had these allies around me as I was about to embark on dying for about 12 years, leaving my body for 12, 15 years while, you know, hanging on to resolve the things that were attacking me and others and just this planet. So I had to leave and kind of fall off the face of the earth so I could look and observe and actually do the metaphysical work and energetic work to be able to get back in my body. And it wasn't until I broke free of the Mars thing that I was really able to anchor myself, because it seemed like that was the last showdown. There was a lot that I had to go through before, but this seemed like, okay, you know, here's the wizard behind the curtain. These are the folks that I really have to confront to complete this. So, you know, the connection to Sophia really is the connection to our organic path of light and just, you know, our essence that, you know, I'm just keeping just as close to me as, you know, to bring back to the planet, to rescue it, because it was almost annihilated. And for thousands of years, it's been misunderstood and buried. And so I'm just very close to that energy as far as keeping it alive and going through whatever it takes, whatever I have to go through in order to be able to, you know, anchor it and awaken it and activate it. So as far as how I see it with Alternative 4, I see it as a movement to resurrect a part of our nature that is exactly the thing that these agendas and these technologies, the negative technologies, have been zapping from all of us. So how I preserved that was to leave my body and to hold on to the consciousness rather than be in my body and have my consciousness, you know, stripped away from me and my soul, you know, controlled. And so it was kind of like, well, I can't inhabit this body and still maintain this awareness. It is just too much for me. And plus, I couldn't bring all my energy into my body because there's a huge block. And there has been for thousands of years. And that's why, you know, people know, and those who study Sophia or Magdalene know that she's basically been in the underworld this whole time. Hasn't gone anywhere, but has certainly not been a part of our world. And so I felt all that. I felt the burial, the exile, the excruciating, you know, tasks that lay ahead of me and the memories of all these past lives and just knowing that, you know, this is a completion and this has been prophesied. There would be a return of this, but not so much kind of in this false second coming that they actually have technologies that they can create. It's the second coming that is resurrecting through all of us. And it's the return of our organic nature, our freedom. And so for me, Alternative 4 on my level and what I can bring to the table is really being able to bring that to light and helping people understand it and where religion has confused us and, you know, really what we're all about that we might not really fully be aware of. And this can really start to accelerate the healing process and rebuild our DNA because obviously our genetics have been affected by these agendas and these manipulations. Humans and these reptilians and grays, you know, are kind of working together. And a lot of what they've been able to bump off the planet is the Sophia. And, that's a part of our sacred nature within. And it's, you know, it's in everybody. So I'm definitely coming out speaking on behalf of that within all of us. Because once that sprouts and gets illuminated, our higher chakras open up, fills our whole being, and we're a lot more protected. We're a lot less vulnerable. We have a lot more of a sense of who we are and a lot more clarity. And we're not controlled anymore by the fear or these lower energies. And so it's really a resurrection of who we truly are. And nothing can really survive in its presence if it has a plot to harm or disturb or destroy. It's, you know, it's going to be starved. All those entities are going to be starved of our power. And what's going to remain is, you know, the true nature of everything. And it connects to so many myths and so much on a lot of levels, and there's plenty of archaeological evidence and you know, evidence that can be proven to back up, you know, the esoterical and mystical and whatever you want to call it. And people, you know, tend to want to blow this off because they think it's New Agey. And, you know, I get kind of frustrated by that term because really what I've been preserving and holding on to is something very ancient, and it's a force that's been able to assist with the manifestation of advanced civilizations and cultures. And, you know, there's been just a game and a competition between that force and this force of control. So I'm sort of here to assist in resurrecting our freedom and our true nature. And it's not about, you know, hierarchy or worship or putting anything, you know, of how I connect to Sophia on any sort of pedestal. It's kind of like it's just something I'm reminding us of, and that's going to serve as our greatest protection and a very important part of Alternative 4. An aspect that is definitely going to set us free, because that's what's been taken away, you know, and it's been taken away the male energies. It's both. It's a resurrection of both, but the particular focus has been on, for thousands of years, the completion of a certain level of the feminine that exists in men as well, that opens us up to a multidimensional awareness, is able to really lift a lot of this heaviness, and all these, you know, polarities and dualities, you know, tend to come into balance, because this is the most balancing force that this planet needs right now. And so it has to come through all of us. It's a co-creation. So,
Alfred, apropos of that comment, I have been subjected to some form of third-party interference. Can you hear me?
Yes. Yeah. You know, we're very happy that you joined us, and Laura has kind of jumped in and held the space because we were figuring that you were having challenges getting back into our conversation.
Yeah, I've had a lot of interference during this first half hour of the second hour, and I don't want to waste the time in the interview to describe it, but it was very bizarre in terms of when I was calling back to get online. I even received a response from Spain at one point. You had just mentioned Barcelona. So without wasting any time discussing the interference, I'm back now on another line, and hopefully I won't be knocked off again.
We can hear you. Better. So I couldn't hear you very
well. Great, Laura. Wonderful.
Yeah.
So what I was describing when I got knocked off was that throughout June of 81, Courtney Hunt was basically asking me, sort of pressuring me, whether I would go to Mars. He had made me aware of the fact that it would be via teleportation. And when I finally said, well, why do I have to go there? You know, I'm attending college. I want to become a journalist. He said, because the survival of the human race depends on it. And I wasn't really considering the overlaps between my Pegasus experiences and the use of quantum access to identify my Mars findings and be able at that time to understand that they may have wanted me to go to Mars because I was going to fulfill a destiny in which I would participate in making the people of our planet aware of the fact that Mars is an inhabited planet. It has its own indigenous ecology and civilization. But just that whole scene that would entail and sort of the shadow side of the Sophia mythos that Laura has been addressing made me reluctant to go up there, because it really ultimately involved a separation from Mother Earth. I mean, I had a visceral concern that I shouldn't leave the home planet, that I incarnated here and I had a destiny that I wanted to fulfill here on this beautiful planet. But nonetheless, when he told me that the survival of the human race depended on it, I relented. And I received very little training. And in July of 1981, and then again in August of 1981, Hunt drove me to a CIA facility in El Segundo, California, where we took the elevator up to the fifth floor, and then we got out and checked in at a kind of a desk where somebody was working, a kind of a counter. And then Hunt instructed me to walk back into the elevator, and I asked him, you know, where's the teleporter? And he said, you're in it. And I said, I am. And he goes, yeah. The door closed. It went up to the eighth floor, and it took about 20 minutes to get to Mars. And as instructed, I walked out of the elevator. This was a jump room, essentially, that teleported to Mars. I walked out of the teleport, or that is to say the jump room, walked up the stairs and out through the eyes of a skull that was on the surface. And I was greeted there by three human beings, and by that I mean project personnel from Earth who were stationed up there. And I was yelling at them, can I take off the mask? And they were laughing at me. And I finally took off my mask and breathing apparatus, and I could breathe on the surface of Mars. It was about 60 degrees. It was like trying to breathe when it's a hot, smoggy day in Los Angeles, you know, and you feel that your lungs are kind of struggling to get enough oxygen. On the second trip up, I went up with Hunt, and we walked about a quarter of a mile from the skull on the surface to this rudimentary stone shack, kind of like you'd find in rural Arizona, where there was a shed or a small house made out of the indigenous stone, or, you know, the rocky material on the surface. And as we walked up to the front door, this creature that had the head and shoulders of a man, but the lower extremities of sort of a grub or worm, came bounding across the yard there, the property, snarling at us and barking sort of at the same time. And Hunt flinched at him, and I said, is he dangerous? And he said, no, he's harmless, or something like that. And we went into the house, and there was a colonist who had been there for months. He was in a state pretty much of exposure. He was sort of half out of his mind. And when we first entered his house, he was actually tripping over his own furniture. It was very cluttered inside this small stone house. He was tripping over various things on the floor to evade Hunt. I think he thought we were there to assassinate him or whatever. And he was babbling about people on his team who had been lost, presumably to some of the predators that are on the surface of Mars. We were chased by such a predator when we walked back to the skull. We actually ran back to the skull at one point. But what I'm trying to do is provide context here. This is 1981. There was already a deep underground base that received the teleport and then received the jump room. There were already colonists up on the surface. There was clearly a skeleton crew in place to create the Mars colony that Laura then would be the subject of a recruitment campaign for 25 years later. So I just wanted to narrate my experience going up to Mars as a 19-year-old in 1981, and then also correlate that to Michael Relf's experience as you were asking me to do before I had the phone interruption. Michael states that he went up there in 1976 via teleportation, spent 20 years working there to 1996, and then was age-regressed back to his original age and then returned to Earth. I believe that's his account. What's very telling about this, and really goes to different ways of inferential proof that I've established in trying to describe to others what and share with them an understanding of what happened to me in Project Pegasus, is before reading Michael's account recently, I had described how one of the experiences I had in Project Pegasus was an age progression experiment where something was done to me at the Los Alamos National Labs or at Sandia. I'm not really sure. I believe it was Sandia, because I when it ended, I found my way back to Sandia. So I was in this set of meetings in which they were going to describe this age progression process that was going to be used on me. But when it completed, I was going to find myself, you know, in my 40s out on the street, and I would have to find my way back to the Sandia campus and talk my way through the security there and so forth. And certainly in 1971, 72, there wasn't the extensive security there that there was when I went back there in 2008 and approached the gate and practically got arrested, just as I had almost been arrested and turned over to Homeland Security when I was taking digital photographs up in Los Alamos of some of the places I had visited as a kid. But anyway, I had described to others how I had participated in an age progression experiment when I was a child on Project Pegasus, where I then found my way back to Sandia as an adult and was placed in a kind of under house arrest, so to speak. I was in a sequestered environment, almost like a prison cell, like a holding area, for a number of weeks until the effects of that wore off and I was a child again. In fact, I remember I read a couple of great American novels during that period of involuntary incarceration. So here, later in the 70s, indeed, in 19, 76, Michael Relf describes being sent up to Mars via teleportation, which is really remains a heretical claim. Many people claim that teleportation has not yet been achieved, but here two individuals who don't know each other are talking about teleportation being used to reach Mars, and this issue of age, progression, and regression being some, one of the technical feats that the Defense Department developed in the 1970s. So Michael has had his experiences where there seemed to be a component of teleportation and then age regression after serving up there for many years. I was only up there for hours. I wasn't really a VIP. I think I was being sent up there to ultimately become part of the Mars colony in the way that Laura was approached in 2006, to be up there permanently. And yet it was really, the whole experience was unsettling. I really didn't feel like I wanted to be away from the home planet. I felt a yearning to return to Mother Earth and to complete my destiny here on Earth. And so it was a very deracinating and ultimately terrifying experience to go up there and feel this kind of cosmic dread as the U.S. military and intelligence community was again trying to plug me into their technocratic agenda rather than allow me to fulfill my humanitarian agenda on planet Earth. And that, now we have the accounts of individuals almost a half generation younger, where we can corroborate the claims made by individuals like David Wilcock and Arthur Neumann that there may be as many as 500 to 600,000 colonists already on Mars, because we have accounts of entirely truthful and ingenuous individuals like Laura describing how they were approached to go up there. So I think that the Mars cover-up is going to break wide open, and certainly in our lifetimes we're going to learn that there has been this secret project to create a colony on Mars. And, you know, earlier in our discussions of this several days ago, we talked about the fact that the idea of placing human beings on other planets so that the human genome will survive somewhere in the universe in the event of a destruction of our planet or an attrition of a large part of the population, in broad philosophical terms, is a good idea. I mean, we want to do that. The difficulty is, the dilemma here, is that this project was undertaken within the defense technical community, the U.S. military and intelligence community, on a multi-generational basis, entirely in secret. And something as significant as protecting the human genome on another celestial body is something that should be known to our entire civilization, debated, and administered in a way in which the broad interests of the human species are taken into consideration and protected in the way that the project is implemented. And we have evidence that that's not the case, that it's been done on the basis of secrecy, possibly some form of eugenicist or racially supremacist pattern, where they've attempted to identify bloodlines that may have a substrate of the Martian genome in the human genome as a result of interbreeding between Martians and Earthians. When the Martians returned from Earth the last time, that members of our species left for Mars to escape a cataclysm. So there's some issues of genetic selection that haven't been debated. We know from genetics that genetic diversity is adaptive, because the greatest number of genes that you have in the gene pool, the greatest likelihood you'll have those genes available to adapt under new environmental conditions. And so if they pick people from particular bloodlines, in the case of Laura and I, some of these noble Germanic bloodlines that emerged after the 30 Years' War, when there was a very substantial die-off in Europe and the Prussian superstate was formulated and our ancestors were some of the distinguished individuals in that Prussian society when it was emerging in the middle of the 1600s, you know, we're looking at a situation here where ideas that were discredited during World War II, during the very military campaign that Laura's great-grandfather led and that my father and his brother served as soldiers in, may have been embedded in some way in the Mars colony project in a way that is untoward and that doesn't take consideration for the net potentialities of the human genome and of human civilization on Earth. So I think that the revelation of the Mars cover-up is critical. I think the notion of establishing a human presence on other celestial bodies so that our genome will survive, if God forbid there's another cataclysm on Earth, is something that is as significant to international public law and policy as the framing of the UN Convention on Human Rights after World War II. And I'm just proud to be working with both of you on bringing public attention to the fact that while it's critical that we think about establishing things like the Mars Colony, these have to be public projects that the entire world contributes to and is aware of, and so that we can go about completing these space projects in the most democratic way possible.
So this is where I'm confused with the Google X Prize and these things that are becoming more public. It seems to be hiding the fact that these programs and these colonies were built from foundations that are questionable as far as what would actually happen if we were there. So what I'm worried about is even if things do go public, it's people are unable to see things from the perspective that we have of what we sort of went through and what we see as the source behind it and the agreements behind it. And it, you know, where fear can start to penetrate humanity and these options are going to be there, but they're built on the foundation of sources that are still using those technologies to control us and could use us as slaves at these outposts. So the fact that there's secrecy also clues us into the fact that even if things were to become public, it still might be hiding the agenda of what would actually happen once we get there. So it's kind of like I see that these things might become more public now, especially that we're blowing the whistle. It's going to all sound, okay, well, this is going to become public anyway, and I don't know what they're, you know, why they're even bringing this up because, you know, it's online and there's programs now. But what my concern is that underneath it all is what we're talking about, and the roots of it do not serve our best interests at all. And if we are going to go to Mars, it needs to be directed and facilitated by those that do not have associations with the misuse of technology and that those that are heading these programs can be the ones with the strong Earth missions that have the priorities set on not a fear-based perception but on a awareness level of, you know, what our potential truly is and what that potential is in terms of these lower races and this fear is that our beings are able to vibrate so much higher than these greys and reptilians, and we're able to reach such ecstatic state of protection and even the ability to just really use our beings and our bodies and our chakra systems to deflect attack and danger, that if we don't, you know, put some kind of attention on that first, then we are only functioning at a small percentage of who we really are while we're still being controlled, regardless of what planet we go to or what the necessity is. So whatever becomes public is still hiding something because the foundation is not coming from a leadership that we can really trust and count on. And so I think a part of Alternative 4 is to look at space travel and having backup plans built from, you know, having integrity and an awareness of what it means to be humane and consider everybody's mission and purpose. So that's just a concern of mine, that even if these things do come public, that it's actually a part of the grand deception.
Well, yeah. Just to follow up, Laura, and I'd like to ask Andy afterward. Let's go deeper into the Mars Colony. Now, you've talked about that you were revealed. It was revealed to you some of the bases on which you were identified as being, why they identified you for recruitment. And I wonder if you could talk about those so we can begin to zone in on this.
Well, what was unusual is I know the bloodline part is important, but for some reason, the unusual part of it is how much the esoteric and the archetypal stuff was brought up immediately. And when finally I got some answers and, you know, we're in the chaos of all or nothing. He would have death threats if he stayed on Earth with me, and if I didn't go with them, that there was threats that I'd be kidnapped, and all sorts of stuff was going on. Everybody was getting sick because the frequencies from his body were so intense and so supercharged on some sort of, you know, communication level of something technological that was feeding him information. That's where I picked up on the chips and the holographic false energy, perhaps. And if not, you know, whatever it was. It was all happening around this point, and as we realized we were going to lose each other, and it was sort of tragic, you know, that one strand of, okay, I'm about to lose her, there's some sort of wave that came over, and he showed up one day and dismantled all the technology in the house, the batteries, the TV and everything, and he revealed to me that the reason they had chosen me, or the reason that he was sent to find me, which I believe has been in the works for a while, and they've known, you know, me since a young age. I mean, it's even amazing that Andy would have heard of me before I was even born, was because of the association of Sophia. And so to me, you know, I hold strongly to a blueprint that we all have, and I refuse to ever let it go, and that's why I left my body for, you know, 15 years or so, to not lose that, because that's what they were trying to destroy. And by the time they got to me, I think they figured I was so broken that, you know, they could set out some dates, which would be, you know, a karmic mate that I felt very familiar with and had a good connection with, to set us up so that he would meet me first before I would naturally meet him. They would have him a part of this big plan, kind of, you know, sweep me off my feet or whatever and charm me. And then whether it was natural or not, the fact that there was a connection. And then often that would be bait that, well, I'll go if he goes kind of attitude. And so I not only had to break through all the different attacks and targeting from the age of 7, I was put through the ringer as far as my heart goes because, you know, here I am like, you know, you want to follow the one that who's your partner and to break free of that for the sake of, you know, the Earth mission and Mother Earth too. And basically if something happens to that's like death on so many levels, unless it's self-induced, and it's an agreement to, you know, reseed. And this is why part of our gathering is to look at these options and to think about off-planet stuff, but under different circumstances and agreement with a whole new foundation. But so what I discovered was that I was also surviving, you know, their manipulation to say, okay, she might be strong enough to handle these technologies and our targets and our attempts to control her, but her heart is where we can get her the best. And I remember having those visions of them trying to stab me in the heart and that, you know, that's her greatest weakness is her heart. And I just had that play over and over in my head, and I was like, no, not going to be. I'm going to, you know, forget that. And at that last moment, just as one of the last conversations I ever had with him until recently, he broke down and told me that everything that's on my website, everything that I know about myself, everything I write about is true, and they know that, and that they know about my kids and just. So to me, they, you know, that's part of my Earth mission is just being who I am, is really awakening, you know, ourselves to break free of what's been taken away and to restore ourselves to our true nature and our true potential. And so they saw that I wasn't going to let go of that, and they tried everything that they could to separate me from that so that they could control me. And when I finally got that communication, that was why I was targeted. And sure, it's got names and archetypal names, but to me they represent terms like freedom, unity, awareness, awakening, you know, just things that are a part of who we all are. That's what they're trying to destroy. So I look at it as a macro level. They're trying to take our freedom, and I represent, in a lot of ways, freedom and justice, just being, you know, having my whole chart be Venus and Pluto and just scales and just all these, you know, just this whole experience of understanding my past lives and my whole nature. I kind of represent a lot of what we need to call forth within ourselves. And so what I figured out was they wanted to take that mission away and that life force that is very morphed into the planet and use it for their own benefit and manipulate, you know, the men to be bait to either destroy me or take me with them. Because in destroying me, they can control me. If I lose my spirit, if I lose my consciousness, if I lose my own self-awareness, it doesn't matter where I am because they can get me up into space. But, you know, this final showdown was pretty heavy duty. And similar to Andy, it's just like it's just one thing after another, and you just keep going, you just keep going. And no matter what they throw at you, you still hold on to that core truth that we are capable of doing something that they're trying to rob us of. And that was way stronger than anything my heart had to go through or any, you know, love in this world. You know, my love of just our potential and this planet and our what we're capable of beyond this planet while preserving, you know, the life force of this one and at least taking care of it in the way that it deserves is far more powerful to me than anything that's ever come across. And so I think, you know, in the end, they couldn't destroy that. And so, yes, they use the name Sophia Magdalene and this and that, but like I said, to me, it's a code name for unity and just you know, the voice of truth and to protect our freedom and our spirit.
Thank you, Laura. Andy, Now, in terms of the Mars colony, you've talked about, and other researchers have talked about, that the secret Mars colony, in fact, is maybe a meta-conspiracy, is something that goes back centuries, and that whereas it may have manifested in our post-World War II technological age, there are roots of it that are now emerging that we're all just becoming aware of. And as a person who has spent a good part of his life coping with and enmeshed in part of the implementation of a secret Mars colony, I wondered if you could talk about that aspect, that historical aspect, that hidden historical aspect of it, and comment on what you think is the validity of some of that research.
Well, Jay Widener is leading the field in this area, and Jay has emphasized, for example, the notion that the Bavarian Illuminati, working through Freemasonic lodges, may very well have founded the United States of America in 1776 to work with ancestral knowledge from the time of the last cataclysm to construct a human survival colony on Mars. Now, we know that by its own statements, Freemasonry is dedicated to a unitary purpose, a single purpose, and that is to, quote-unquote, rebuild Solomon's Temple. Well, Solomon's Temple apparently is the Great Pyramid at Giza. This is the emblem that was placed by our Freemasonic founding fathers on U.S. currency, the Great Pyramid with the capstone of human enlightenment being placed on it. The Shriners call themselves the Ancient Arabic Order of the Egyptian Shrine. That's why we call them Shriners. And obviously Jordan Maxwell and other, and David Icke and other researchers have gone into this multi-generational conspiracy under Freemasonry to achieve some kind of meta-purpose that relates back to the high civilization of ancient Egypt. Well, when we look at the fact that the Great Pyramid focuses on the king's passageway, the passageway to the king's chamber on Mars the same day every year, and a red orb forms on the wall above the head of the sarcophagus of the king inside the Great Pyramid. When you consider the fact that the organization that you and I, Alfred, founded, the Mars Anomaly Research Society, has found abundant evidence of the high Egyptian fingerprint on the data being derived from the surface of Mars by NASA's rovers Spirit and Opportunity, including Ross Curley's very significant finding of a carving on a rock that depicts not just the face and head and hat of an Egyptian pharaoh, but we can even see Wadjet, which is the cobra ready to strike motif on the front of this conical hat of the head and shoulders of the Egyptian pharaoh in that particular intaglio. I found the sarcophagus of a king on the edge of the home plate plateau in NASA image PIA 10214, which the analysis of which was the basis of my landmark paper, The Discovery of Life on Mars, in 2008. So we have also, obviously, the brilliant work done by Richard Hoagland and Mike Barra working with Carl Munk on the fact that the D&M pyramid complex, named for Vincent DiPietro and Gregory Molinar of NASA, who discovered the face on Mars at Cydonia, but also the pyramid complex south of it, the pattern of which we find at Earth in only three places, basically at the Great Pyramid Complex at Giza in Egypt, at Avebury in England, and it's also the design that was embedded into the site plan that the French Masonic urban planner Pierre L'Enfant designed for President George Washington when he created the the site plan for Washington, D.C. So these different data points are now linking up to establish that there was a nexus between the great maritime civilization that built the Great Pyramid and the Sphinx and the great platform at Baalbek in Lebanon and Mars. I think the only question at this point remaining is, was Mars a colony of that Earth civilization, or was that Earth civilization that flowered and then was destroyed in a catastrophe around 9500 BC, was that instead a colony of Mars? I don't think we really know the answer to that yet. Graham Hancock has also done some brilliant writing on this subject in his book, The Mars Mystery, which shows that we need to be asking this question about the placement of a human survival colony on Mars in antiquity, or vice versa, because we may be hit in the future by the same solar system phenomenon that destroyed the last civilization on Earth. So we're faced with a meta-conspiracy. It seems to have carried forward as a result of Masonic influence in government and in the professions, including engineering, architecture, structural engineering, and so forth. We have some telling facts from the occult literature that we're now beginning to synthesize into the overall explanation of what's been going on. For example, there was always a mystery as to why Skull and Bones, the secret honor society at your alma mater, Alfred, Yale University, placed the number 322 on its insignia. And why would it raise a cadre of young people to grow up and provide common aid and financing to each other, even agreeing to commit political assassinations and sponsor wars and narcotics trafficking to maintain some overarching project of great significance? Well, Jay Widener has now given us the explanation that 322 on the Skull and Bones insignia refers to March 22nd, the day that the zodiac enters Aries or Mars. He states that the Aryan blood groups, which were identified by the great American legislator and paranormal researcher Ignatius Donnelly in his book Atlantis, the Antediluvian World, are the Celtic, Germanic, Slavic, Greek, Italic, Persian, and Indian blood groups. That Aryan doesn't refer to people with blonde hair and blue eyes, like some Swedes, but in fact refers to the Indic-European blood groups that have a substrate of Martian genetic lineage from when the Martians returned to Earth after that cataclysm. Such individuals would have larger noses to both filter a dusty atmosphere and to warm air in a cold atmosphere in order to survive. We have the coloration of the Indic-European peoples, such as the red-haired, green-eyed phenotype that would be perfectly adapted to the surface of Mars with its rusty red soil and primary vegetation. So what's fascinating about the time we're living in is these disparate data points are starting to converge, and we're starting to see that there has been a meta-conspiracy to place a human survival colony on Mars. In other words, the Masonic goal of rebuilding Solomon's Temple was rebuilding a command and control center to place the human presence back on Mars. Well, when NASA achieved, for example, the lunar landing, and we made our first step onto another celestial body during this epoch, during this second civilization to flourish on Earth, we found that it was done with the involvement of two Freemasons named Neil Armstrong and Edwin Buzz Aldrin, and that, in fact, Buzz Aldrin was a more highly ranked Freemason, and he was supposed to step out on the surface of the moon first when Neil Armstrong took the initiative as the captain of the ship and stepped out first. So there was Richard Hoagland and others have established the Masonic, the hidden Masonic history of our space program. So we know we're dealing with a multi-generational meta-conspiracy that was focused on achieving a space launch capability and putting a human presence back on the moon and particularly on Mars. Clearly, there was the overt program that flourished during our lifetimes in the lunar landing program, which was successful in July of 1969, of landing on the moon via conventional rocketry. But the significance of my account is that there was a tandem program, that Pegasus was the secret twin to Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo, and that there was an alternate plan to use the teleportation technology that had been left in Nikola Tesla's papers at his death in 1943 to enable us to get to the surface of foreign celestial objects virtually instantaneously. I mean, we didn't get there as quickly as we got between New Jersey and New Mexico when I was a child in Project Pegasus. But we, Courtney Hunt and I, got from El Segundo, California to the surface of Mars faster than you can fly a plane from San Diego to Los Angeles. We got there in about 20 minutes. And while there was some uncomfortable sensations of dealing with the pressure right around the midpoint in the journey, I found physically the journey there easier than taking, let's say, a transoceanic airplane ride. You know, imagine, for example, Los Angeles to London. I'm usually utterly zonked by the time I get to London from the west coast of the United States. Consider the journey from London to Sydney, which is a 24-hour plane ride. Well, we've been getting to the surface of Mars in 20 minutes for decades, and this is being kept back from the people of our planet because this multi-generational effort to put a human survival colony on Mars has been carried out via secret organizations and then ultimately secret defense technical activities undertaken by the United States during and after World War II. I think ultimately, though, the revelation of the cover-up will enable us to reconsider the entire project and start asking the important questions about how such a colony should be constituted. What are the threats that would cause us to be motivated to create such a colony? Do the people of the Earth not have a human right to know about what the ultimate cosmic destiny of our planet is? How does this issue of a secret colony on Mars and the photographic evidence that has already been published of a base on Mars? You know, we had that brave act that Bob Dean evinced at the European Exopolitics Summit in Barcelona, Spain, in July of 2009, where he revealed the satellite images of one of the bases on Mars. And, you know, we're still debating the veracity of my claims about teleportation and the U.S. government having achieved a Mars, you know, launch capability via teleportation. Well, Bob's shown us pictures of the bases there. How did the bases get there if we haven't already been there? You know, why would somebody, such a nice individual as Laura, be prevaricating around this issue? Why would I be motivated, you know, after attending UCLA and Cambridge and law school and working hard to establish myself as an attorney, why would I be making up a strange story? No, that's not what's going on. What's going on is that truthful people are speaking the truth, we're standing in our truth, and we're beginning to share the truth that the U.S. government has been advanced for generations in what has now become a very extensive program that implicates human society in what is going on the surface of another celestial body. That's fraught with political, diplomatic, social, and environmental implications that we haven't even been thinking about, much less debating publicly. Do we have a right to settle on Mars? You know, in light of the fact that Mars is already inhabited, not just with animals, but with a human civilization that may be related to us, but that certainly has been on the surface of Mars for thousands of years before we re-entered the situation there. Do we have the right to visit Mars? What is going to be the impact of our attempts to explore Mars and to inhabit it? What was the origin of the underground facility that I was teleported to in 1981? Was it an abandoned Martian humanoid underground base? Was it lent to us by the Martians? Was it being co-administered by a Martian and human government? Or did we build it as colonists, and were we defending it in opposition to the indigenous humanoid civilization on Mars? I know from my personal experiences with my father, him being a distinguished aerospace engineer and we working together inside of Pegasus, that the Martians that resemble us were in common cause with our aerospace community in 1970, because my father and I had a brief encounter with several of them. I had a brief encounter, but my father had more of an extensive interaction with three Martian humanoids that were visiting Curtis Wright on a technical liaison mission. And I had the privilege of meeting those three gentlemen from Mars as they were leaving Curtiss-Wright to return to Mars. So there are just a host of facts here that need to be explained. They need to be correlated. Those of us who have information are going to stand in our truth, and we're not going to be intimidated. We're not going to worry about the pattern of vilification of us and the manipulation of incorrect facts and incomplete facts in trying to discredit us. And as you know, Alfred, I have even more information to share with the public about Pegasus. I'm going to be naming the names of the scientists involved and where they were working and what technologies they were working on. And I'm sure if Laura and Arthur Neumann and myself and Michael Ralph, four individuals who don't even know each other, didn't know each other until our work around Mars began, that more individuals are going to come forward and acknowledge the secret human presence on Mars so that its implications can at least be considered by the human population on Earth.
Can I jump in real quick?
Sure.
Just split something up really important. I mean, I realize, you know, things got out of control. There was this, okay, so the treaty with Eisenhower about the alien race dying out. Why would the alien race die out? What race are we talking about here? Reptilian or gray or grays, right? So what got out of control was the secrecy about this treaty and the technologies that were being exchanged and the fact that the abductions and all this got out of control. Well, it got out of control because agreements were made and humans that should be assisting humanity have actually joined in with these alien technologies to continue this on some sort of barter of maybe the promise for world power. I mean, this gets very esoterical as far as how one might view God and the devil as you know, choosing power over integrity. And so what I was seeing when you were just talking was that, you know, what's gotten out of control is this these agreements with these, you know, different alien technologies to implement this plan that is now almost becoming an artifact of the negative timelines and the old alternative scenarios that we're busting out of. So, you know, we can see what's happening on Mars and what's taking place in our world up to this point. But those things took place before you and I were born, some of it, and some has been just in your awareness what you were communicated as a child. But now here we are now. Project Looking Glass can't see past 2012. And this is what I was telling you guys before. When I was in Mexico and I was a teenager, I remember sitting by the Aztec calendar and all the Mayan stuff, and the tour guide was saying, you know, after the fifth sun, there's no real prediction of what's going to happen, and that was the 2012 date. So I took it upon me at that point, kind of knowing that I'd been targeted and having a deep sense of what I was up against and intuitively just knowing that, you know, really having a clear sense to what I can articulate now, I knew back then. I didn't need this whole Mars recruitment to know that this type of stuff was taking place. That just really validated it. I'm like, yep, here they are. But anyway, so I was clued into, on a creative level, really being able to bust out of all those old agendas that are very stale now. They're still there, and they still cause us concern. But in my view at this point, it being 2000 was considered an important juncture for catastrophe in this and that, and that's why the other alternatives were even created. So we bypassed, you know, I don't think people can understand that the human spirit, regardless of what it's told or what future events are going to happen, we have the ability to reach further. The minute we know something, this is what's so important about having the truth out there, because the minute we know something, we grab for something further. Our creative abilities extend beyond the information that we're getting. So you could say, this is going to happen, but then all of a sudden the mind reaches, well, what, you know, it tears down, it has the capability of tearing down a timeline or a scenario and getting over it and almost going through a life and death to get to the next level, which is sort of what my path has been about, almost defying death, being able to die so many times so that I could live out the potential of one timeline and actually die off with it and be able to birth myself again to kind of resurrect a whole new scenario that has a chain link to all these different Venus transits. And so when you think about the celestial bodies of Venus and Mars and their connection, that's kind of a relationship that I'm trying to heal in a way or work on. But so what I'm seeing now is these agendas are old. They're not old. They're still trying to stay alive. But when things got out of control and humans and aliens started to play this abduction game and this research about it. Here we come in, you know, able to, you know, similar wormholes and just creating a, you know, being on the path to create this natural stargate that's available to us, transcend, you know, all these different timelines. So what we're dealing with is a restatement of the powers, you know, the powers that have been running everything are now losing their power to people like us, who are those that are empowering everybody through speaking the truth. And that force in itself is wiping out a small portion of the population that's been running the show in a negative way. And so what I'm seeing is these timelines are dissolving. You know, all what we've become used to is dissolving, where all, like you and I and Alfred and others who have survived, you know, being quiet and being threatened and being destroyed, the fact that we've survived it is what has trumped it all and caused the complete and total breakdown of all these other possible scenarios. So now we have to take the reins and reinvent the resources that we have and the knowledge that we have, a whole new game plan. And I know I'm being redundant about empowering Alternative 4, but I see it in a whole new light after seeing you talk of what is the real deal here. Something got out of control, and the fear was in 2000 that we wouldn't have a chance. So it was okay to use mind control technologies because humanity wouldn't be able to handle it anyway, so might as well control them because they're not going to want to listen. But I feel like what we've survived has torn a whole new dimension that was always there but completely blocked and veiled. And that's, you know, when you read about myths, they always talk about veils. And I always knew as a kid, I'm busting through veils, I'm lifting veils, I'm busting through timelines. Those are concepts I was always just playing in my head. And so now that we've made it to the other end, I think it's time to just empower the dismantling of all this and really, you know, coming up with a whole new game plan and a whole new foundation that we're the new pioneers and not necessarily the leaders, but the guides to this new shift and this, not new shift, but the true destiny that we're all about. So I don't know if I got way off track, but it all dawned on me that, you know, what it's really come down to is this out-of-control abduction thing and this manipulation and cruelty of how people are tortured and human mutilation and cattle mutilation. And that's such a huge dilemma of how these grazing reptilians have gotten out of control. Enough people are supplying them power to keep their race alive. And the only reason they ever wanted their race to stay alive is so that they could, you know, breed like parasites. I mean, they're more a germ than anything else. So what we're dealing with is kind of, as an earth body organism, almost like curing ourselves of a disease. And we have the wisdom and capability in our own natures to know how to do that. And so we have to kind of be metaphysical doctors of Gaia right now. Because I am not going anywhere, you know, without, you know, and I think you both agree that we can't abandon what's here. And I am not coded to do it. I'd rather die, so.
Right.
I can't die.
And, yeah, nobody. Yeah. And talking about 2012, just to put down a marker, because we're already into hour three, and I'd like to steer our conversation into talking about what Alternative 4 looks like in terms of very practical terms and in terms of the kind of thoughts and plans and visions that we have to have. But Andy has a very vital data point for us in terms of the meme that's been put out about 2012 being the end of time and all of that, because Andy, you've been to the year 2045 in one timeline. Is that not correct?
Correct. We were jumping from or through a Stargate device that was assembled in the Olympic-sized basketball court that was built by the WPA during the Great Depression at the Cultural Center compound in Cerrillos, New Mexico. There's an Olympic-sized basketball court and then a symphony orchestra-sized stage. And some of the chronovisor activities that I took place in New Mexico were on the stage. But then during the summer of 1972, the first summer of 1972, my fourth hidden summer in New Mexico, they assembled this huge anvil-shaped Stargate. It reminded me sort of a bigger version of one of those black colonial-era printing presses. It was this big black gate-shaped object that focused on a doorway at the bottom. Actually, we'd have to run up a ramp, and then there was this doorway that was illuminated with dense neon blue light that we were trained to run up the ramp with a nonstick black rubber surface and jump through that portal. And then we would pop into, we'd have another experience in a vortal tunnel, just like when we were jumping through the device at the old Curtis Wright Aeronautical Company facility in Woodridge, New Jersey, and then popping out in the State Capitol Complex in Santa Fe. In this instance, we know we were headed somewhere in the future, and we knew we were, and we would pop out in front, in sort of like an industrial park in the future, and there were these beautiful multi-storied emerald green buildings, several of them, and these broad plazas in a kind of a garden city of tomorrow kind of setting. I think Ebenezer Howard would have thought they did a good job, because there was clearly a settlement there. There were these office buildings, but there was a beautifully lush garden like you might find around, you know, a hospital in Hawaii, something like that. And individuals were going by on the broad plaza on the Sedgways, you know, those devices that Dean Kamen invented where you push this lever forward and you move along on this single wheel. And we would go inside that building, and we were given these capsules that had microfilm summaries of future events. And I know that we have continuity to 2045, because in one of those visits, when I was there to pick up one of the data scrolls and bring it back, two young women working at that facility walked through the lobby and pointed to me as I was coming inside the lobby, going, oh, that's Andy. That one must be Andy. Yes, that's Andy. As if they knew me in the future from the historical accounts, I guess, about my telling of Project Pegasus, presumably in my book. And then we would jump through a wall of the conference facility there and have another experience going through a tunnel in time space. And we were popping out in the ground surrounding the microwave tower at the Lobo overlook site immediately west of the Continental Divide sign on Highway 160 in southwest Colorado. And from there we would be bused back to, you know, Santa Fe and Albuquerque and the other cities in New Mexico where we were staying during those summers. So I went on several trips where we jumped to 45 and jumped back from wherever that location was. They wouldn't tell us what year it was, and they wouldn't tell us where they were located. It was only as a result of two of their technicians being back at the gym at Cerrillos that I and one of the other boys in the program walked by them and said, hey, listen, what year are you guys from? And they didn't realize that we hadn't been told, or we weren't supposed to be told, what year they were in. And they said, you don't know? We're from 2045. And then they went about continuing to work on the Stargate device. Some kind of component had to be replaced. I also learned at that time that some of us had a genetic propensity in our generation that allowed us to teleport forward in time, and then that genetic component was possessed by the people from their time who were capable of jumping back. But clearly, that might have been another reason they were using specific children for the time-space program. So I can confirm that at least on that timeline, there is not only continuity of government, but that society has reached a sustainable level, and that mass disaster didn't occur. And when I hear Laura's discussions of the positive timeline, that she has a strong conviction that we're already in, I think she's right, and I think I saw the fulfillment of that timeline, because this was a future society where society had achieved a balance between the built and the natural environment, in which the people I was interacting with were fit and intelligent and kind and helpful, and where they were liaising with our government to try to help the United States play a leadership role in getting to that sustainable society in the future that awaits us. So while I think we're going to be going through a period of turbulence here during the first several decades of the 21st century, I think by mid-century we do reach a more perfected society where the disaster talk of 2012 is seen to be what it was, which was a disaster meme that was propagated and given different time references. You may recall, you know, I call 2012 Y2K plus 12. I mean, similar accounts of mass disaster were being talked about for 1997, for the year 2000, and then for 2012, even though it was really an archaeological artifact from the Mayan civilization in which the end of time may have meant something entirely differently. different than mass disaster involving the destruction of planet Earth. I think those memes have been part of the multi-generational psyop that has been used to prepare people for the Mars colony. If, for example, you can tell somebody, you're special, we want to save you, your genetic pattern, and have it present in the human race in the future, and it's in your interest to leave the planet now because the planet's going to be destroyed, or the planet's going to be impacted by something terrible, that can be a means to get somebody over their natural aversion to leaving Mother Earth and take up habitation on another planet that is far less fertile and beautiful and wonderful than this planet. If people could sit down with me for several hours and have me go through my Mars findings and show the life forms that exist there and the sparse environment that they're desperately coping with, I think they'd have a greater appreciation for what we have here on this beautiful planet and be more dedicated to trying to preserve it. But we do preserve it. We're part of it. We have to build structures to protect us from the elements, but we arrive at a more sustainable society. So, for example, when I visited 2445, there were no automobiles, and hence no automobile pollution, accidents, stress, noise, fatigue. I didn't see any airplanes in the sky because most of the intermediate and long-distance travel was being performed via teleportation. The Segway and bicycles were being used, for example, by people moving between buildings in the same complex. So I think a wonderful future awaits us in the 21st century, and that part of this is overcoming these fear scenarios that were propagated to cause people to become selfish and obsessed with the techniques of getting off planet or of improving their material position on the surface of this planet. When other natural life forms don't do that, animals don't hoard more than they need regularly. They don't live in 5,000 square foot mansions when they can survive in a 500 square foot apartment or a 1,000 square foot house. And so I'm fairly convinced that Mars experiencers like Laura and myself and Michael Ralph and Arthur Neumann were part of an effort where they were testing different ploys, different scenarios to entrain people to be willing to relocate to Mars. I mean, I think I was the individual who was trained from childhood and then approached in late adolescence and just sort of casually taken up there. I think with Laura, they used a more deeply embedded mythological framework to ensnare her in going against her nature and her intuition and go up there, even though she knew on a soul level that her destiny is here on this planet. I think Michael was involved, obviously, in the age progression and regression technology that I had that one singular experience with as a kid on Pegasus. And I think Arthur Neumann is what? The mid-career professional who was sent up there, I guess in a similar way that VIPs are taking junkets up there via teleportation and staying in some of those sort of high-tech, state-of-the-art, subterranean hotel and conference center-like facilities that we've heard accounts are up there. I even had a call from a Montauk researcher from Kansas after I appeared on Coast to Coast AM on November 11th of last year, who claimed that his research revealed that cattle barons from Earth have already placed cattle. They're already raising cattle on Mars, which would make sense to involve ruminants to chew grasses and to fertilize soil and kind of enrich the biosphere up there. But the funny thing about that is I said, did you realize that in my paper, The Discovery of Life on Mars, I showed this black steer standing on a hillside? And he goes, no, I didn't realize you had any pictures of cows in your paper or your work. And I said, yeah, we found an image of a cow right there west in the hills west of the home plate plateau. So clearly the human presence on Mars is much more extensive than the public has been informed. Each of us have gotten separate glimpses of it. But I think what we're going to see in the next 10 years is really a complete rollout of Marsgate, and the deception and the sequestration of this knowledge is going to come crashing down, and then the human race will have at its disposal the opportunity to decide whether to continue to emphasize on these expensive trillion-dollar space projects, these secret defense projects, coming from a place of fear, or more public and open programs of direct investment in public problems on Earth, like hunger and homelessness and poverty and disease and ignorance, and the things that President Kennedy challenged us to fight against and to create a better world as an alternative to. And I know that was also what was motivating Laura's great-grandfather. You may recall that when President Eisenhower issued his warning about the military-industrial complex, it wasn't just from the perspective of power. It was because of his concern that the influence of the military-industrial complex would have an untoward effect in the councils of government and would drive the American government away from what it should be focusing on, which were the very things that President Kennedy then challenged us to focus on, like hunger, like disease, like war and poverty and ignorance itself. And so I think that's what this is about. If we can get a handle on the investment that's been made in Mars, we can take an accounting in what we haven't spent those dollars on in terms of creating a sustainable and democratic and benevolent civilization here on Earth for all of the 7 billion inhabitants of our planetary spaceship.
You know, and that's very interesting. I just want to note that there are now two terms that if they haven't been coined here, at least they've been mentioned here. First, Laura mentioned Alternative 4 as the new umbrella term for sort of the golden age type society, a universe society that we want to create here on Earth. And now Andy has mentioned Marsgate, which kind of crystallizes the title that we started off with this program before Laura said Alternative 4, which is what the program is really about. And Marsgate really kind of crystallizes, and it's alternative that it's ironic that Watergate, the principal figure in Watergate, was Richard Nixon, and that Richard Nixon is probably a seminal figure in Marsgate, which is the final exposure of the secret Mars colony. And I just want to say, I want to ask each of you, Laura and Andy, from an Alternative 4 perspective, because we're now into hour 3. We have about 30 minutes left. From an Alternative 4 perspective, that is this society in the positive timeline that we are now all mutually creative, what the Mayan scholar says, touching on notes that both Andy and Laura have said, Carl Johan Kalman says, oh, it's not catastrophe, it's just new consciousness, that we're not bound by constrictions on consciousness, that the universal axis and the galactic axis through the galactic center black hole have been sending out, but now in a post 2012, really in a post 2011 framework, we create the reality. So I'd like to ask, first starting with Laura, how you see that positively we can create this Marsgate and flip the Mars colony around into a positive, mutually beneficial Mars-Earth relationship, which ironically is what we put forth in the book Exopolitics.
Yes, well, I'm willing to do whatever it takes as far as, you know, creating conferences and pushing myself towards the people that need to listen to us in whatever way I need to. I really don't have time to rest. I'm feeling very accelerated on the action orientated nature of all of this. I do believe that the end of time really represents the lifting of the veils to where time and life and death have taken on a whole new meaning, that we've learned how to be creative enough to access parts of our nature that have been sort of hidden from us, where it's required a life and death experience in order to keep coming back and evolving until we reach this certain fruition and completion to where we're just vibrating as an eternal being that are capable of you know, just multidimensional travel, really. And, you know, a lot of technologies can supplement this until then. and they're ones that can assist us and join us. A lot of William Henry's work relates to this type of stuff. So what I see is that we're kind of flipping the coin. We're sort of, the powers are shifting. And what I see positively, and what I notice in the voice print charts, at least for my nature, is there's only 6% of energy that I'm running in my body. I've got about 94% that's hanging out there that I'm having a hard time bringing in. That's all creative energy. And so if I'm functioning pretty good, you know, with all the demands that I have on, you know, about 10%, 6% or whatever the number was, I know that there's a lot more left. And so I think, you know, on a collective level, that's true for many, that we're slowly bringing in more and more of ourselves as we kick out all these forces of suppression and control and manipulation. I think there needs to be an active plan to really look at TARP and what these man-made cataclysms are about, because any natural cataclysm is just a result of us being so unable to go through the necessary shifts inside that the planet that we're connected to is going to create those disasters as the shifts, you know, for us. Because we don't really ever die. We're going to end up someplace else once our physical bodies are gone. But what I'm trying to preserve is, and what I'm trying to keep alive is consciousness. Once we lose consciousness and something's controlling us, then we're in trouble, whether we lose our body or not. And we end up being born into the same scenario. So when we break free, we don't have to fear the physical body so much. I believe we will hold on to our physical bodies, though, and that it'll take us, you know, far, and we'll shift into all sorts of things. But what I'm really trying to keep alive is consciousness. And, you know, after 2012, when we've really broken free and we're really utilizing all that we have, all the power that we really have because we've reclaimed it, we, you know, not only will we be mass disclosure on the truest of levels, on multi-levels, we will be able to transverse the conditions and the natural laws that we've grown accustomed to. And a lot of the mythology that I know is very real, because it's about the wheel of necessity ending, about the wheel of karma, the tree of good and knowledge have exhausted itself, and we finally have restored the tree of life. And all this opens up to heaven on earth and to everything pouring in from the higher dimensions that supplements this planet, everything that it needs to heal, giving us access to all the wisdom and information that we need to be able to build in accordance to the laws of nature. But, you know, nature is an alchemical thing. It's actually transmuting itself, and the light body within Gaia is going to be activated as well, which is going to change the nature of everything. So, you know, as we have alchemy in our soul, you know, this is happening on a world soul level where everything is really shifting into a whole new paradigm just cosmically. And so our job is to keep up with it as humans, but we're not just humans. We're a part of this creative process. And what these forces and negative agendas have convinced us of is that we're powerless and we're just humans and, you know, we're out of control and the earth is just going to do this or that to us and we have no choice, we have to leave, instead of allowing us to see that we're co-creators and that we're actually, you know, extensions of nature and earth and that we are doing this with those forces. So we have to differentiate what is trying to get in the way of that and what we need to do to empower, you know, the real forces that are ours that have been taken away in a sense. And, you know, and that's going to happen when we're loud and putting on, you know, talking as much as possible and strategizing, you know, on a regular basis, you know, with a list of things that need to be tackled one after the other. And that's what I see. But on the metaphysical, on all these other dimensional levels, I see even more. And I'm not going to continue, but just a little glimpse of, you know, things like that. There's the core. You know, there's a sun in the middle of the planet, just like the sun in the sky. It's the core. And there's things going on that are changing and shifting just in the natural law of things, in the cosmic things that are assisting us greatly. And we just, you know, we just have to get rid of the splinters, the germs, the parasites, the controllers, expose them, and empowerment is what's really going to knock them off the map and starving them of our power. And the more loud we are about this, it's the awareness that's going to set us free.
Thank you for that. We'll come back to some of those themes. Andy, how do you see Mars Gate rolling out in terms of this alternative four, new timeline, positive timeline, empowering, expanding reality that we're all co-creating now?
Well, I would just like to share my experience over the last several years of dealing with the data of life on Mars and then the political and social struggle to have my findings accepted by human society, which really hasn't been a struggle on my part, but it's just something that I've let happen as a result of releasing my data to the public and letting the public come to its own understanding of the fact that Mars is indeed an inhabited planet. And hence, before we, a major part, for me, a major part of the Marsgate is that we really have to have an intelligent exopolitical debate internationally about how to interact with and interface with an entirely different planet and civilization, with the ecology of it, with any governmental authorities that are present there, and clearly with our humanoid relatives that have been occupying Mars for much longer than we would seek to. But just on a personal note, my fascination with Mars really forced a growth process that I really hadn't confronted in my own character and energy pattern, as it was. And that was, I found myself like a kid in a candy store or in a toy box, confronted by the most intriguing data that somebody could be looking at. Images of animal and human and plant forms and so forth, not many plant forms, but primarily humanoid and animal life forms on another planet. And, you know, I had many discussions with you and our colleagues Ross Curley and Lewis Michael Reinhardt and our different international correspondents around the world, Paul Goodwin in Great Britain, Greg W. Brown in Australia and others, about how privileged we felt to be, you know, to be in possession of some of the first sets of human eyes to look on these natural treasures that have evolved as a result of, you know, life's yearning for itself, as Khalil Gibran framed it, on another planet. And there were times when I was almost reduced to tears, quite frankly, about the opportunity to be in a generation where not only is this information coming to light, but that I was blessed by my Creator with the privilege to be deeply engaged in the information as it was emerging. Now, the quantum, or not quantum, but the sort of the cosmological paradox was, at the very time that I was immersed in something that, you know, Alfred Einstein described as the cosmic religious sensibility, you know, the sense of your...
Oh, thank you for mixing my name in with the archetype inventor genius.
Oh, well, you've been
because you said Alfred Einstein.
Oh, did I say Alfred Einstein? I meant Albert Einstein. Sorry. I was a Freudian slip, sorry.
Yeah.
But, no, at the very time that I found myself deeply immersed in what Albert Einstein described as the cosmic religious sense, you know, where you feel like you're actually directly engaged in the creation itself, and you're kind of in this altered state of consciousness, kind of this creative fugue state that results from being deeply engrossed in scientific or artistic creativity, which for me was analyzing the photographs and writing papers about them, which I've been doing for several years now, and also, you know, consulting with others. I was being called the worst possible things on the first truly international communications medium to emerge on planet Earth, which is the World Wide Web. For me, the biggest joke was being called a paid government disinformant, when in fact the sad reality of my situation is that I'm an unpaid anti-government informant. I mean, I've been down to the food in my refrigerator probably 20 times simply by becoming more engrossed in my Mars work than in gainful employment. So I learned something that was sort of inherent in human nature and in our confrontation as social organisms with the rest of society, and that is when we turn from positivity to confront negativity, we inherently lose. So for me, it was an example. I had that fewer seconds to write up my Mars papers. If I had to write some snappy response to Dr. Michael Sala or Steve Bassett or Daniel Pinchbeck or one of my many critics on the Internet who are accusing me of all manner of things and actually engaging, I think, tacitly in a form of ethnic prejudice by not even showing any concern about properly spelling my last name, which is, of course, is one of the initial rules of fair engagement in any debate, is respecting the person you're debating with. So I found myself sort of inherently having to choose between positivity and negativity, between trying to participate in the growth of the universe to acquiescing with a struggle over its decline or its diminishment. And I arrived at a policy, and I know I haven't always defended myself as vigorously as I should, but I really ultimately think that the truth is going to emerge. So I decided instead to stand in my own truth and to tell my own story without fear or favor. Because I think, as we've learned from, certainly from Laura's account of her experiences, that as human beings, the power of story has a tremendous power. It may, in a sense, be the primordial power that human beings hold to cause other human beings to become entranced in a story told around the campfire. I think it's a very primordial, primal aspect of being a human being. So I think telling our stories and having the courage to tell them without fear or favor is an essential part of the digital age that we should be trying to foment and encourage. Encourage people to come forward and tell their truth to the best of their ability to tell it, which is what I've been trying to do both in terms of my Pegasus revelations and then my Mars findings. Doing that, I've been trying to remember, keep in mind, that while I'm an individual, I don't represent necessarily myself as an individual. I embody humanity just as everybody else does, ultimately. Both humanity now alive on our planet and all human beings who have ever lived or who will ever live. And that, therefore, what I should be focusing on is not my own egoic values, such as protecting myself from these untruthful castigations and collateral attacks that are based on ego and ideology and just negative impulses, but instead to continue to focus on what the great harbingers of human progress during the 20th century, you know, your Buckminster Fullers and Jacques Cousteau's focused on, which is the broad societal human interest that they can bring about through their own individual efforts. Because as I've said in my writings, ultimately we know that human destiny turns on the brave acts of individual human beings. And if some of us don't have the courage to tell what we know about this government cover-up, then it's going to be kept back from humanity for generations. And we're all going to find ourselves in a technocratic nightmare, or our descendants are going to find themselves in an advanced, enslaved in an advanced technocratic society that clearly doesn't have their best interests at heart. We're already starting to see that pattern in the military regimentation of society, the lack of regard for human values in the way that our cities are designed, the way our foodstuffs are being raised, indeed, the way our whole economy is being administered under a universal price code. In other words, we're starting to see that, I don't know what you would call it, that dystopian nightmare that may worsen if the Mars Project widens and our focus becomes more extensively placing a human quasi-military presence on other planets rather than making the world an even more beautiful and functional place. So that's sort of the lessons that I've learned. Now, it's been difficult because I have an ego like everybody else, and unlike most people, I've spent many years becoming credentialed academically and intellectually. So when I'm being attacked, I'm an individual who's made a sincere and substantial investment personally in trying to become a capable enough intellectual to somehow participate in the process of human betterment. So I don't just feel personally offended when these attacks occur. I feel professionally offended. But then I recognize that we're not living in the hierarchical world that we were living in even when we were children and adolescents. The big development has been the advent of the World Wide Web. We're not living in a hierarchical command and control, top-down society anymore, even if the individuals who focus on those institutions are still deluded that we are. In fact, we're living in what Buckminster Fuller called an omnicentric civilization, one in which the focus is outward from every individual human being and inward into the center of their being. And so as long as the World Wide Web is protected and not brought down by some kind of tyrannical counterforce that would oppose it, this is the new infrastructure. So when I go on the Internet and I read an article by Alfred Lambermont Weber in which he's interviewed Laura Magdalene Eisenhower, and I'm finding out things that might never be published, at least initially, on the front page of the New York Times, I'm living in that omnicentric reality that Fuller predicted, and clearly the infrastructure that's supporting that orientation is the Internet. So I think, to that extent, character assassination and lies and concealment of government conspiracy and so forth that causes such attacks cannot prevail. It cannot be sustained. The truth will out because the means to bring the truth to people now exists and is widely defended. And so in that kind of context, where we're all basically on stage now, we all have the capacity to make history, report history, share history with others, and influence human destiny directly, I think the overarching lesson for revealing Marsgate and what it represents is the theme of positivity. We have to continue to practice the discipline of trying to be governed by our higher selves. And for me, that involves, for example, not becoming angry when I read something on the Internet and somebody's attacking me, usually curiously based on facts that aren't even accurate. In other words, I don't feel I've been attacked based on what I have said or claimed. I feel I've been attacked based on things that I never said or claimed because the individuals engaged in the attacks don't have complete information. Just as for that matter, I don't. I'm also recognizing that the reason to not be recriminatory and negative and go negative, the reason to try to persist with a spirit of positivity is that we are all fundamentally part of each other anyway. So, for example, an individual who would possess negative thoughts about me is part of the shadow self of myself. And an individual who would write me some of these utterly sincere and heartfelt and positive messages to me, several of which have literally caused me to start crying in gratitude for people's support for my work and the struggle that I've maintained over many years now, also causes me to recognize that just as I possess a higher part of my being, that same thing is present in other people, because in fact, ultimately, we're all part of the same superorganism of the human race. And so that's the struggle, to not turn our work in exopolitics into another political vanguard attacking others to raise an ideological advantage, but rather to try to focus on what's positive, address the negative, not necessarily hold particular people responsible for the negative, because ultimately we also encompass the negative just as we encompass the positive, but try to embody the positive and maintain a discipline of positivity. And that, I think, will become the governing ideology of the 21st century.
Yeah.
Andy, sorry, Laura, I didn't, what I wanted to ask you was to take that thought that Andy ended on, i.e. the relationship of alternative for the higher self and the future that we're coming into, and ask you, Laura, in a unique voice that you've started to speak in, and that is the voice with archetypes like the Divine Feminine, Sophia, and, you know, which are connected to your higher self, and sort of talk to us as to what how you see your higher self and all of our higher selves now that we're beginning to understand that it is our higher selves that can create this collective reality that we coexist in. What are our new guidelines? What are we going to be doing?
Right, right. Well, I think Andy touched upon it very nicely, and just our whole conversation has sort of led it to crystallize in this awareness. Is we can't make the negative go away. We can't make darkness go away, and we don't want it to. But it's the same sort of dilemma we have with technologies and all the conditions in the world. Everything that we have, we need to utilize. It's like colors on a palette. It's all a part of our artistry and our and the masterpiece that we're coming up with. The thing that we need to do as creators and artists is know how to adjust things and add things to the difficult spots and places that can bring it new form and new meaning. So if, you know, there's a mistake or an accident, one can be creative and say, okay, well, if you add this, it actually looks like a tree, or if you do this, you know, you can tweak it. Or when one's feeling dark, well, that darkness isn't going to go away. Well, where does that darkness belong? That's the creativity. That's the womb. That's the place of birth. That's the soil. That's where growth can happen. And consciousness and love and wisdom is where the light is. And so because we deal with these polarities, we would like to marry them. When you marry light and dark, the light actually gets grounded and the dark becomes enlightened. And, you know, so we have to really look at the fact that everything that is surrounding us, we can't really get rid of, but we can certainly know how to adjust it to where it's where it should be, just like, you know, our roles in life. We each have a specific role, and the more true we are to ourselves, the more everything will fall into place, and the dots will connect. The same thing with, you know, our attitude, our thoughts, our moods, the way we treat one another. These are crucial, you know, to take full responsibility for how these forces work in us. We even have to take that, you know, inner, that darkness, and through osmosis, we pick up the things that even Hitler did, and we have to take responsibility in our own beings to be able to sort out all that information and energy and perfect ourselves to the point of not perfection, but we know what belongs where. That dark force is actually much better channeled into this rather than ego and the need for power. And people have to take responsibility and look at themselves and replace, you know, certain areas that are dark and put it into their creativity and into their depths of feeling and connection rather than have it run through their third chakra or their ego, which wants to overpower everybody. Because these are weaknesses. These are survival techniques. These are defense mechanisms due to a lot of trauma and maybe difficult childhoods. And a lot of people are running around kind of disorganized with their energies, you know, probably with ancestral patterns that they can't really trace or get rid of. So, you know, everybody really just needs to take that responsibility. The archetypal part of it is when you come down to it, what's the divine blueprint? It's, you know, male and female harmony. It's the sacred marriage. It's the sacred union. You could call it Shiva Shakti, Christ Sophia, Isis Osiris. And this is something that is naturally a harmonious connection that exists within us. On the global stage, on the world stage, there's a major sort of need to rebalance those energies and work out the archetypal dilemmas and dramas and arguments and power struggles and sort of stop, you know, with the wars and look at each other and have that compassion that you have for a family member. Be able to, you know, kind of drop it, move on and let go and just forgive and just say, okay, hey, these are all parts. This is exactly what Andy was saying, and I write about this a lot. This is a part of me, and in order for me to be able to heal it, I have to integrate it within myself and find resolution and move on from it. And know where to put it so that's a force of change and regeneration where the darkness does well rather than the darkness, you know, controlling our actions, which can lead to more destruction. So, you know, when we understand the archetypes and what I've gone through many gateways and many dimensions and many lifetimes, just in this one lifetime and you know, before, is take on those challenges and meeting, you know, very strong representatives of different archetypes, including Dionysus and Osiris and just the Plutonic energies and Dark Lords and, you know, you name it, everything under the sun that I won't run through this. But what it enabled me to do is to create resolution, to create that harmony, to go in the depths, the deepest, deepest depths of what I consider the world soul and take on and face, not by choice, but just, you know, surrendering to the adventure, creating resolution with all those different layers. Now we have this other challenge with this Mars gate and Alternative 4. We have lingering challenges that need to be dealt with. We have to realize that what we can't make go away, we have to make resolution with. And so it's a big peacemaking campaign as well, and it takes a lot of humility and a lot of strength to put that ego aside and our own personal needs and really look at ourselves as in that oneness and recognize that the Earth organism is like our body, and humanity are almost voices in our own head and different levels of our own being that we need to master. So life gives us the opportunity to become masters, but if we're in competition with it and we see it as separate, then the wars are going to continue. So these are the most necessary things. It's putting the puzzle pieces together. And, you know, the entities that are controlling us and the agreements, like I said, they'll fall off the map. It's like somebody who's never able to get over their traumas and their wounds. They end up manifesting disease. And, you know, we have historical traumas that we're still, you know, locked into and, you know, maybe seeking revenge or it's like what I get, what we all have in common is this sort of selfless nature and this, you know, desire to do the right thing. We do get hurt. We're very sensitive. We don't like attack. But, you know, taking that responsibility and not stooping to that level, and kind of letting it just move through us does not empower the game that wants to keep us engaged in that frustration and that feeling of loss and the disconnect of you know, feeling like a fellow brother, sister, or global family member doesn't care about us. And, you know, so I think we're going to be leading by example and just really speaking our truth and being bold regardless of the obstacles and the opposition. And, you know, it'll inspire others to do the same. And so it's Mars Gate. It's Alternative 4, it's the golden age, it's the age of awakening, and I just know that we're going to hold that that strongly and be a light for others to be inspired to get to that level and take responsibility for the dark forces in their life and integrate it and transform it, which I call soul alchemy, to transcend it and rise like the phoenix and let whatever needs to be let go of, you know, compost, and look at that as something that can strengthen the darkness. Everything that we let go of is just like compost, and the new seeds that we plant are going to be way stronger than ever if we can just recognize that nature and the earth and the cosmos are our greatest teacher, and that they'll show us everything we need to know as far as how to move through our cycles and rebirth, and you know, the ecosystem is very diverse and it knows what it's doing, and that exists within us. So there's multiple alchemies going on just on this planet and within our own souls, and you know, if we can surrender a bit to nature, I can guarantee that Mother Nature and Mother Earth knows exactly what it needs us to do, and we just need to walk hand in hand. Everything else that's in competition with it is a part of it, but there are inorganic elements and energies that were birthed from the beginning of time that, you know, will definitely dissipate as long as we're not living in those negative patterns and we can put darkness where it belongs.
Yeah, thank you. You know, we're coming to the end of this particular segment, and I certainly want to issue an invitation to both of you so that we can follow Alternative 4 and Marsgate as this develops. And this particular possibility, just at the very practical level, came to me as you were speaking, Laura, and that is that this particular facility that we're speaking on now can hold a relatively large number of people that we could have on a conference call that's recorded, and then we could put it up online so that we could design a Mars mini conference, say a Marsgate mini conference, and invite people on as sort of something immediately that we can do within our resources, and then that would go online throughout the internet, throughout Facebook, throughout articles. And I'm just kind of tossing that idea to see how just ask each of you how you react to that particular idea.
I would think that would be a great production that I'd very much like to be a part of. I'm getting incredible support in my Facebook community, with not just at my website, but at Project Pegasus and at the Discovery of Life on Mars. And I think that sometimes the flaming that goes on in the chat boxes that are published beneath articles and so forth really kind of obscure that fact. I've gotten hundreds and hundreds of supportive emails and messages from people over Facebook. There really is a yearning throughout the world that people have to be told the truth and to know the true history of our solar system and also the true technical history of the latter half of the 20th century that we're going to need to understand to construct a sustainable society in the 21st. And I can't emphasize enough how I think the more participatory you make the model, the more you get a true measure of the optimism of the human race in this generation. There's a lot of positivity out there, but the mass media often doesn't focus on it. It focuses on instances of human aggression and depravity, warfare, for example. But I'm getting messages from absolute strangers who are completely affirming my soul mission on the deepest level of its cognition. And if you think that, you know, 10 years ago I was in opposition, you know, artificial opposition ultimately, but I was basically in some social fallout with some of my siblings and some of my old and dear friends in Los Angeles because they just couldn't believe what I was talking about. They couldn't understand why I had never talked about being in a secret government project in childhood, for example. But
I can relate to something you just said.
Yeah, I simply had not discussed what I experienced, but I had, in fact, made reference to my experiences for many years. So I've gone in 10 years from being disbelieved in the basic claims of my story by intimates in my life to having literally my overarching spiritual purpose affirmed by complete strangers. So for me, that's a measure of the fact that there's a huge reservoir of positivity that exists in the world today. I wouldn't even say particularly among young people, because I think that's kind of a hackneyed way of formulating it. I think as a group, at all ages, we're entering into a positive age in which people are taking responsibility for their lives, for what they know, for what they think, and they're not taking pat answers. And for me, it's been a privilege, for example, to be able to publish images of life forms on Mars and not just speculate as to the possibility that Mars might be inhabited, but actually show that it is. And we have to start thinking about what that means and what we should do. But yes, I would love a participatory model like that, because whenever those platforms are structured, I just get a huge inundation of positive responses from people that convinces me that we are going to make it, and that the human race really does possess the buoyancy and the optimism to survive any challenge and to perpetuate itself as a civilization.
I agree, and I'm absolutely available and open to anything. And same experience with Andy. I never talked to anybody about this. I went from maybe talking to two people to having strangers and all sorts of people embrace me, and surreal and shocking. I'm still every day just in awe that I can be free with this. It's been a burden I've carried. I haven't been able to talk to anybody, and if I tried, it was, you know, people did not want to deal with it, and I was very, very isolated. And so this is all an incredible omen, and it's really the time to do this. So I'm all over it. So anytime you can call on me, and I'm there.
Great. You know, and just to note, it's very interesting that Andy says 10 years, because the exact same thing that Laura, you say, and that Andy, you say, happened to you, happened to me. And this is the 10th year. This is the first decade of contact from 2000, the year 2000, to the year 2010. I wrote Exopolitics in 1999. It was put on the Internet as a free Internet book in the year 2000. And that was the first time that I really put any of this out there. And I had a similar experience as both of you. So it's been 10 years, and I think that it's interesting that it goes from the year 2000 forward, which seems to be some kind of a marker, that this kind of positive-oriented timeline has really accelerated. I really want to thank you both. I mean, really from the bottom of my heart, from all of my heart, for being here in this space and for communicating to the world. And I do believe that we are changing the field and changing all of the many dimensions in which we interact as we speak this way, and I look forward to our getting together again in future venues of many different kinds. We've been with Laura Magdalene Eisenhower and Andrew D. Pashago as our special guests. Laura's internet address, her website is cosmicgaia2012.com. Andy can be reached at projectpegasus.net and projectmars.net. This is Alfred Weber, and you're listening to Exopolitics Radio. May you have a wonderful and miracle-filled day. Thank you.